You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
We have a very exciting event here this morning. Primary focus is on the U.S. and Chinese economies. You know, U.S. and Chinese economies are in the news a lot these recent days. Actually, they're in the news all the time because China and the U.S. are the two biggest economies in the world. In the case of the United States, once again, the economy is disappointing this year. The IMF recently marked down the U.S. forecast from 3.1 to 2.5, which is a pretty significant markdown. A lot of the discussion in the U.S. is when or whether the Federal Reserve will start raising interest rates. A lot of concern around the world for what will be the impact on emerging markets. So we'll definitely talk about the U.S. economy. In case of China, the economy is slowing down. Looks pretty good to hit the target of 7% this year, but that would be the lowest growth rate in some decades. Chinese stock market has caught a lot of attention with a spectacular run of more than 100% increase, but then that was followed by a very sharp and sudden correction that caused a lot of nervousness around the world. So plenty of things to talk about concerning the Chinese economy. There are also interesting issues of global economic governance. You know, China launched the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. That's got a lot of attention. We're talking about whether the Chinese currency should be included in the IMF's SDR. That's another important issue. Now, you notice the way we structured the program, it's not directly about U.S.-China economic relations, but in discussing all those issues I just mentioned, we will inevitably get into U.S.-China relations. And an important backdrop is President Xi Jinping's state visit to the U.S., which will occur in almost exactly 2 months from now. Now, to discuss all of those topics, we've got an outstanding program. We've got a really great delegation of Chinese economists, former policymakers, and entrepreneurs visiting Washington. So we welcome this whole delegation. We've got some very significant entrepreneurs who are participating in the delegation, but the discussion up here will be among the economists and the former policymakers. We'll introduce people before each panel, so I'm not going to name names at this point, but we're going to have two panels, inevitably with some overlap. The first one focused more on the U.S. and Chinese economies, the second one on global economic governance. You'll be happy to hear there are no set speeches. The whole thing is a conversation. So we'll start with the moderator asking some questions and generating conversation among the panelists, and then we'll have lots of time for question and answer. And then the last thing I need to mention is that we've organized this together with David Lee and the Center for China in the World Economy at Tsinghua University. David is also the dean of the Schwarzman Scholars Program. If this is successful, which already looks like we've got the foundations for success, we'd like to make this a regular event. Tsinghua University, CCWE, and the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. We could do some events in China. We can do some events here. And now I'm going to turn over to David to make some introductory remarks, and then we'll launch into the first panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. I have been to Brookings many times as invited speaker or visitor. But today, I am particularly excited because this time around, I am helping putting together a large delegation visiting the Brookings Institution. A little bit background to bore, maybe not to be too boring about this delegation. That is, 3 years ago in the 18th Party Congress, the Communist Party announced that the country needs to modernize its governance system, modernize governance system, like 国家治理, 体制要现代化. And one of the ingredients of a modern governance system of the country has to be think tanks. So President Xi Jinping issued lots of personal documents emphasizing the importance of building or beefing up Chinese think tanks. And Vice Premier Liu Yandong, who is in charge of education and research and cultural events and sports, having the biggest portfolio among all the vice premiers, right, got this mandate. And where she turned to? Her alma mater, Tsinghua University. She's from Tsinghua University. Not only she went to our chemical engineering undergraduate program, she also went to our Tsinghua affiliated high school, truly a Tsinghua product. Anyway, so our leader at Tsinghua University said, we better do something to improve our think tanks. Center for China in the World Economy is one of our think tanks on campus. And then we did the research, how to improve our think tanks. There are experts working on this. We went to University of Pennsylvania. One expert told us, easy, easy. If you want to improve your basketball skills, play with the best guys. Here we are. We're playing with Michael Jordan of think tanks. That's Brookings Institution. So here we are having a delegation of think tanks. I am from the Center for China in the World Economy. And also we have Deputy Director of China Center for International Economic Exchange. We also have associates of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and many other institutions. This is a learning trip. This is a trip to pay homage to Brookings Institution. Soon you will be 100 years old. I was told you are maybe unofficially the oldest think tank in the world. Well, congratulations, and we are here to learn. The best way to learn is to work together to discuss something which is important. Today, the Chinese economy, the U.S. economy, the global governance, these are important issues. So to me and to us, this is the best way for us to learn. Let's play a serious basketball game with Michael Jordan. Let's start. Let the ball start. Thank you very much.
I'm going to moderate this first panel. I forgot to mention one important thing. There is simultaneous interpretation with English on Channel 2 and Chinese on Channel 10. The topic of the first panel, you know, it's really about the two economies. And, I'll signal right now, I'm going to start with Don Cohn, talk about the U.S. But first, just let me briefly introduce. You've got the bios, but we've got a really outstanding group here. Don Cohn is the former vice chairman of the Fed, so he's sat in the meetings where they actually make the key decisions, and now he's a senior fellow here at Brookings. Also serves on the British Monetary Policy Committee. Is that right, or is that a secret?
Financial policy. Stability.
Okay. Right. Zheng Xinli, as David already mentioned, is the vice chairman of CCIEE, one of the leading think tanks in China. Probably most important key author of the Communist Party Third Plenum Resolution on China's economic reform. And David Lee, I've also already introduced, but I probably should mention you were previously on the academic committee that advises PBOC about monetary policy.
Monetary policy, yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to start with Don Cohn because there's so much interest. As I mentioned, the IMF marked down the U.S. forecast for 2015, but at the same time, and I don't know, was this unusual? Christine Lagarde publicly urged the United States not to raise interest rates until 2016 and raised concerns about the effect on emerging markets. I don't know if that's going to affect China. So I think I'd like to start with Don, you know, giving us some thoughts about this decision. Nobody knows when they're going to make it, but, you know, what are some of the factors? And then what's the, you know, the impact on emerging economies? Should they be so worried? Is this really such a big deal?
Well, thank you, David, and it's great to be here, especially wonderful to be compared to Michael Jordan. That'll never happen to me again, I'm sure. It's not for my athletic ability that I'm quite certain.
How about Tiger Woods? Next time it's Tiger Woods.
So you're right. The IMF did mark down the U.S. forecast by about half a point, I think, for 2015, and the first half of the year has been a bit disappointing in growth. Certainly it's slower than I expected and a lot of other forecasters expected. Some of this is transitory. We had an especially difficult winter here, especially in the eastern and northeastern part of the United States, which impeded economic activity. There was a port strike on the West Coast. So there are questions about the seasonal adjustment of U.S. data. So there are a number of factors that might be temporary and transitory. But the fact that the IMF and many other forecasters mark down the yearly forecast suggests that there's something a little more persistent about the disappointment. I think one thing is that the decline in energy prices seems to have had a much quicker and sharper effect on energy investment, I think, than some people expected, and a less of a positive boost to consumption than some people expected. And perhaps the rise in the dollar has had more negative impact on net exports. But still, the outlook is for moderate growth. I think the fundamentals of the U.S. economy are pretty good in terms of fostering growth. Fiscal policy is in about a neutral range. Monetary policy is very accommodative. You do have these lower energy prices helping the consumer. Consumer confidence is higher. Business confidence seems to be a bit higher. So I think we're the outlook for continued growth, and continued growth a bit faster than the growth rate of potential is still in place. And I want to emphasize that last than the growth rate of potential piece, because I think one of the disappointments in the U.S. and around the world really has been very slow growth of productivity and potential supply. So productivity in the U.S. has been increasing very marginally, flat by some measures, and labor force participation, the amount of labor coming into the market looking for jobs has been also a bit disappointing. So the supply side of the U.S. economy, like the supply side of many other global economies, has been disappointing. It's important to keep this in mind because the Federal Reserve's objectives are not for growth. The Federal Reserve's objectives given by Congress are for stable prices and maximum employment. And by maximum employment is understood to mean the highest employment you can maintain without creating inflation. So when you have a situation where potential growth is very sluggish, then you don't need a lot of demand growth to start achieving those two objectives. So even though growth in the first half of the year has been disappointing, employment has increased quite substantially over the last 6 months. There's been ups and downs, to be sure, partly dictated by the weather. But on average, it's still growing very rapidly. The unemployment rate has fallen. It's now at about 5.25%. And interestingly, the IMF's prediction for unemployment for the U.S. is 5.5% for the year. We're already under that. So I think even relative to what the IMF anticipated, potential growth has been more sluggish. So I would say even with only moderate growth going forward, 2.5%, give or take, you're going to continue to make progress towards the Fed. And the Fed sees the potential for continued progress towards its two goals of maximum employment and stable prices, its 2% inflation goal. Now, remember, on the inflation goal, we're under 2, and we're trying to come up to the 2% stable price goal. So I think the Fed Chair Yellen said in her testimony last week, she thinks that if things go as anticipated, beginning raising interest rates sometime later this year is a realistic expectation, despite Christine Lagarde's advice. And I think the reason for that is, even with moderate growth, the things that the Fed's looking for, how low unemployment getting down to its lowest sustainable level and inflation getting up towards 2%, are very much are in view. And remember that monetary policy works with a lag. So you've got to start raising rates from extremely low levels before the economy overshoots. So I think it's understandable why she, Chair Yellen, continued to say that the second half of the year is a likely prospect for raising rates. What will be the effects of this? It's very, very hard to tell. I mean, we've had rates at zero since November, December of 2008, almost 7 years of zero interest rates in the United States. I think the Federal Reserve is trying to mitigate the risk of market strong and over market reactions by a couple of things. Number one, trying to be clear as possible in their communication about what might be coming. And that's what you heard from Chair Yellen last week, just warning us that get ready. The conditions are likely to be in place for raising rates, and the more you warn people and the more they take actions to get ready, the less serious the reactions are likely to be. The second thing they're doing is saying, look, that first increase in rates from essentially zero to maybe 25 basis points, that's not a big deal, right? You've got still very, very accommodative monetary policy. And we are telling you our best guess is that the rate of increase of interest rates will remain low for quite a long time, and the rate of increase will be quite gradual. So they're emphasizing the whole path of interest rates going forward and how gradual that will be, trying to hold down, damp down any market overreaction. Even so, I think once you start after 8 years of zero, it's logical to think there'd be some market reaction and some effect on other countries despite the Federal Reserve's efforts. Still, I think if they were to wait too long because they were concerned about these effects, there could be a worse outcome. So if they wait long, one thing she mentioned in her test in response to a question was the longer we wait, the steeper the trajectory once we start raising rates. And I think going a little earlier and a more gradual trajectory will be less potentially destabilizing than waiting and going at a steeper trajectory. So the Fed recognizes that whatever it does is going to have an impact on other countries and the global financial system. It's trying to damp down that impact, but it has to do what's right for the U.S. economy, or the consequences would be even more adverse for the global economy.
Can I follow up on this issue?
Yeah, we want to make a conversation.
Two very simple questions. I hope you can answer. We really, really want to know. Okay, first, what's your personal assessment of the probability of the Fed hiking the interest rate in September? Second, what is your reading of the market's assessed probability of hiking? In other words, I'm trying to know whether the markets will be surprised by the actual hiking.
So I think the markets, I don't have a specific probability, but I do, let me answer the thrust of your question, which is I think the Fed seems to have a higher probability, and I agree with it, than the market has built in.
Okay.
So the Fed has been very clear that this is data dependent. It'll be the incoming data that dictate it, whether the economy is following the path. I think there are people in the market who are doubtful that interest rates will be raised, perhaps because they're doubtful that the economy will follow even this moderate growth path and inflation will begin to come back to 2%, or they just think the Fed is going to wait and wait and wait. So I do think there's an issue here between the Fed's intentions and, in my view, the most likely outcome, which is either September or December, and what the market has built in. That's one reason why I think there could be at least some market reaction when the Fed begins to move. Now, they have opportunities. For example, they'll be having a meeting in, I think, a week or so that no one expects them to raise rates at, but they'll have an announcement afterwards. And their announcement will help us see how they're assessing their progress towards their goals. So they won't say, we're getting ready to raise in September, because that would contradict the data dependence mantra that they're in. But they could say, well, we're seeing some pretty good progress. We see some hints that inflation is beginning to move up towards the 2% goal, and that would tell us they're getting ready. So I think if they can use their communication to make the reaction more gradual, and what they most want to avoid is misperceptions and overreaction owing to misperceptions.
So the bottom line is the market will be surprised when the hike comes.
To some extent.
I'm asking this because I'm preparing my Chinese investors. Our Chinese investors, we should be prepared for a shock when the hike finally comes.
But this could be phased in. So it could be. So what I'm, my other part of my story here is that the Fed will be getting us ready for this. So it might not be no, yes, big reaction. It might be a gradual adjustment depending on the Fed's communication.
And the IMF call on the Fed, according to you, wouldn't be very effective.
So I think the IMF, I'm sure the Fed heard the IMF's thing, but the Fed has to make its own decisions for relative to its domestic policy objectives. So I think, yes, according to me, my expectation is that despite the IMF call, they will find that they're going to be raising rates in the second.
The Chinese counterpart, the Chinese central bank, usually is much more attentive to the IMF calls, right?
No.
Usually, oftentimes. Anyway.
I think China and the U.S. are similar in that they listen, but they don't necessarily respond.
To the World Bank, right? To your former employer.
Same thing with the World Bank. They listen, but they don't necessarily take the advice, which is what they should do.
Yeah. Right.
But thanks, Don. That was very helpful.
Thank
you. One reaction I have is I think people often, when people worry about what's the impact on developing countries, you know, they don't appreciate that the Fed is only going to be making these moves if it has confidence that the U.S. economy is recovering toward potential.
Right.
That's the most important contribution the U.S. can make, is to have the economy grow well.
Yeah. Right.
So we'll have more chance to talk about interaction between China and the U.S., but now I want to turn to Zheng Xinli, talk a little bit about China. He's been one of the key architects of the third plenum resolution.
And also the father of AIIB.
I thought that would come up in the next panel.
The
father of AIIB. But there's a lot of overlap between the two panels. But what I wanted to ask Mr. Zheng, you know, there's so much in the third plenum resolution. My perception is that some things are moving pretty fast, or things are moving slow. But my perception, of course, might be wrong. So I'm interested, do you think that there are one or two areas where reform is moving very quickly, and are there a couple of important areas where reform is not moving? Kind of what's your scorecard after about 2 years of implementation for the new reforms?
The third plenums that have come out with more than 100 some of reforms, mostly are economics. Such reform is different from the time before. In the past, is from bottom up, and that the older and that we would accumulate, we would evaluate our experiences on that. But for the third plenum's resolutions, is that they are going to ask the departments and the government agencies to adopt the implementation regulations. So in the implementations will have to be approved by the system reform office, and this was my old unit too. And they will evaluate the reform proposal that is submitted by the departments and see if that's in accordance to the spirit of the third plenum. And after the evaluation and assessment, and then after the discussion of a Politburo, then they will put into implementation. So all those proposals have been submitted to the up level that some of the departments have already taken the steps of the reform. That, for example, decentralization, and for example, to the market access for the financial sectors. And so that we have already taken steps in these areas. But some of the major reforms that in the stage of a preparation has not yet been activated. Now, for example, the reform of SOE, for example, the rural land reform, and the SOE reform, they have to reform the SOEs, so that the employees should have the starts. That we have to change from managing the capital, so that we have we are still debating on what kind of proposal we should do. And as for the land reform in the rural area, maybe is the most potential area for reform. And but the thing is that this is such a broad issue of the rural land reform. Now, so we are trying to do some pilot programs in some areas. That the decision of the plenums have included that we all and we also voted on those, that we were going to fully implement all those decisions. That I don't think you need to have any question about our determination. Thank you.
Can I follow up? HUCO reform. So this is one of my favorite issues: is reforming the household registration or HUCO registration system.
That's a household registration reform, and that some of the cities has already begin the reform. And so that the reform that will follow the spirit of the third plenum decisions, that we have to change, we have overturned the divisions between the rural area and the urban areas, and that we have to overturn that as a separate registration systems. That in the rural areas, they don't have enough of the public services. So we need to give them more. In the future, we will allow that the labor, the workers, to free flow from going from rural area to the urban area. And also the HUCO system that will have to enjoy basically the same public services. So this is the focus of our household system reform. And that's that we also have some pilot programs now undergoing.
What are the major impediments to the relative slow reforms in certain areas? 主要的阻力是什么呀? 什么原因使得某些改革比较慢? 能不能帮我们解释一下?
Could you tell us why that's so slow in some areas? Now, I think that the obstacle of the reform is coming from the our conventional thinking of the people. But in ever since the reform, they have the way they do their things. They have the way they work. And therefore, the reform that decided to plan them is going to make overturn the way that we do things. And we have to change our conventional thinking. So for example, that the household registration systems that we have tried to reform for we've been adopting them for 50-some years, and now we want to do some reform. And now we want to allow the farmers and the people who live in the rural areas come to the city. And it's that wherever they can have their registration, they can have their hukou, where they work and where they live. So that we have to change the whole system. So I think the biggest obstacle is probably from the way we think, the conventional thinking, and the way we used to work. And so this time around, when we do adopt this reform, we are going to make a breakthrough in this area. So that we have some of the difficulties when doing this household system, is that because of the financial problem?
Questions, but since we have a good one, the question is, is one of the obstacles to HUCO reform the financial issue, which I interpret to mean the fact that local governments would have to provide a lot more in terms of basic services, mm-hmm. health, education. And for China as a whole, it won't make any difference. But it does depend a lot on how the fiscal system is organized. Mm-hmm. So either Mr. Zheng or Mr. Li.
Yeah, can I? 我再补充一个问题,
yes, I will let add one question.
The relative slow pace of reform is caused by the anti-corruption campaign. 我们相对比较慢的这个改革，是不是跟这个反腐有点关系呢？
Now that's a talk about this issue very frankly. I think that the financial issues is only the problems on service, but that for those cities that have more of the farmers coming in, whether they are willing to provide them with the public services for those farmers once they have their household registration there. That's for the third 30 some years. And those are cities that who have more of the farmers or workers coming in, are those cities that we have wealthier cities. So because for those workers and farmers, if they have they settle down in those areas, that you can see that all the cities they can bear the burden of providing them with the public services. That, so now that is the problem is that whether we are going to recognize the contributions of those farmers and the workers to the for the building and of the establishment and development of the local cities, and to provide them with just housing and provide their children with a good education and provide their elderly and can come to live with them in the cities and to enjoy of the, some of the elderly services in the cities. So I think after the reform and opening up, that they have attract a lot of farmers and workers coming to the cities. And then of course, the cities have to provide a lot of financial burdens for this situation. As for the anti-corruption, what does it have to do to delay the reform? I don't think there is a great impact on the reform. And as for the anti-corruption, may have some effect on those public servants who haven't done anything. Now the government is going to do a reform on those government employees who haven't been done anything, that they're in action. So this has never been happened before. So some of the government employees haven't done so good about that. So anti-corruption, they may have some negative impact on some of the projects, but I don't think it have any impact on the reform.
Okay, let me turn to David now. Obviously, the world was captivated by this tremendous run-up in the Chinese stock market. It seems strange to me that the real economy was slowing down quite dramatically, and finally the Chinese stock market took off and rose more than 100%. And then it had a pretty sharp correction. It was about a third of the value, and now it's bounced back some. So I think it's down about 22 or 25%. So I guess the question I want to ask you is, do you think financial reform got out ahead of some of these real reforms we were just discussing? Some of the real reforms are they're moving slowly. Maybe it's just implementation's difficult. Governor Joshua Tran seems to have done a lot with financial reform. Is that a factor here? And whether it is or not, how will this stock market correction affect things going forward? Is the lesson that China was moving too fast in some areas and you pull back, or is the lesson that you really need more coherent reform in order to develop a healthy economy, healthy companies, healthy corporate profits?
Yes, it's a wonderful question. But I think overall, the financial reform is still behind the schedule announced by the third plenum. Overall, the financial reform is still dragging the feet of the real economy. Overall, that's the general picture. Mm-hmm. Give you one example. Small enterprises are still struggling in the credit market. We have here among our delegates, we have an entrepreneur, Mr. Qin. Where's Mr. Qin? Who is actually a pioneer of this kind of reform? He's lending to small businesses in small amounts. He's got 50,000 people working for him, private business. But this is despite the government's policy to encourage him. He's on his own, right? He soon become number one, in China in doing this kind of small lending, right? Anyway, overall financial reform is still very slow. It's still drag is in the preventing the real economy from realizing its efficiency, mainly because small enterprises are not still getting their much needed credit. In this general picture, in the regulation part of the stock market, some reforms were pushed too fast, frankly speaking, especially the one allowing small investors to become highly leveraged in playing in the stock market. This time around, when the stock index reached 4,000 Shanghai Composite Index, there are some articles saying this is the beginning, only the beginning of a bull market, right? This is the only beginning, not the end, right? So reading this People's Daily editorial, many inexperienced investors began to invest. Poor timing. Not only did they invest, they borrowed money from banks, from the securities firms. And sure enough, the price shoot up to 5,200, the index shoot up 5,200, and dropped down to 3,500. Tremendous adjustment. So over there, we can argue, the overleverage was huge, draconian force forcing the market to make an adjustment. Within 20 trading days, 1/3 of the market value was lost. That's premature. So China is not ready to have this kind of high leverage in the stock market because overall, Chinese liquidity is tremendous. The ratio of M2, of money, to the stock market, to the tradable market share, is 4 times. In the U.S., it's the other way around. In the U.S., it's only one half. Your M2 is only one half of the total tradable market capitalization of your stock market. So in China, I would argue that reform went too far. Now, I should argue that this time around, the stock market is becoming more efficient. It's very cruel to say this. Here it's easier. In China, it's very cruel to say this because many people lose money. Why? Because last time around, the stock market shot up to 6,200 in index, corresponding to a PE of 72 times last time in 2007. In November 2007, Chinese stock market, the main board, was having a valuation 72 times PE. Now this time around, I calculated our PE at peak was around 28, 29 times before the 30% adjustment. So you can see the stock market is becoming more efficient. The problem is, in terms of social impact, is draconian. It's very punishing for many inexperienced shareholders. And also, let me also emphasize, thanks God, the capital account is not completely open. If the capital account is completely open, then you can imagine a lot of investors who have made money in the first round, in the initial round of the bull market, right, leading towards the 4,000 index, would bring their money, would invest in the U.S. But this, again, might be good for the economy overall in the long run, but that certainly will cause a political economy problems. Many, many conspiracy theories will be there in the Chinese marketplace, right, will be in the end jeopardizing the whole reform process. So this time around, I think policymakers will become more cautious on the capital account convertibility than before. And that's the impact on the overall reform process. And again, another implication is that the RMB internationalization will also have to be more carefully thought, more carefully considered after this episode, because that issue is linked to capital account convertibility.
So, of course, we've had big stock market corrections in the United States as well, not that long ago. I think, Don, you were actually on the committee, FOMC, at the time of the global financial crisis, and our stock market dropped about 50%, but not quite as quickly. Now, China's taken some very extraordinary, somewhat ad hoc measures. You know, a lot of shares are not suspended trading. Big shareholders are not allowed to sell. I think they've stopped short selling. Now, in the United States, we stopped short selling during that last financial crisis. I'd like Don to comment on, you know, whether you think that worked well for the United States, and whether you have a view about these ad hoc measures that China's taking.
So the SEC banned short selling of certain financial stocks kind of in the middle of the crisis as things were falling apart very rapidly after the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy.
All shorting or only naked shorting? Shorting. The different kinds. All shorting.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. It was a very, very small proportion of the...
Not
across the board, yeah. For sure. Just a few financial firms. I think some of us, even at the time, wondered whether this was not really dealing with the underlying problem, but was dealing with a symptom, and would itself impair liquidity in the market, and probably wouldn't do any good and could do some harm. I think it was on for a short time. It was in the context of a very severe crisis for the whole economy, a very severe recession. So I guess I would be skeptical that these ad hoc kinds of things really helped to promote the development of the market and the liquidity of the market. I hope the U.S. Is very sparing in any usage of this, and I think that's the last time, the only time we've used it.
You mean you hope China?
Of the kinds of things like banning short selling and that kind of thing. Yeah. I think that's not a good idea.
I'd like to make one addition. In terms of China's financial problems, I'd like us to pay more attention to China's monetary policy in the recent 4 years. The stock market fluctuation this time in terms of its impact to the macroeconomy compared to our fiscal, our monetary policy from the past 4 years, this is not as significant. So from 2011 to 2015, we have in fact tightened up our monetary policy. From 2011 to 2014, in those 4 years, our M2 growth, annual growth, it's around 13.5%. In the first half of this year, our M2 growth rate is 11.8%. Prior to that, in the 20 years prior to that, from 1991 till 2010, during those 20 years, M2 growth rate is around 20.5%. And economic GDP growth is around 10.2%. So M2 growth rate during those 20 years has been twice the GDP growth. So this observation actually corresponds with Friedman's regulation, Friedman's perspective. So in the 90s, I've come to Friedman in the U.S. and asked Friedman, how do you control inflation? Because he is a financial statistician, he told me, if you look at Japan, look at Korea and Taiwan, doing fast growth, if you keep M2 growth at twice the rate as GDP growth, it is just an appropriate rate. And in China during the 90s till the early millennium, this trend has again proved that Friedman has been right. But in the most recent 4.5 years, our M2 growth rate has slowed down or decreased for 7 to 10%, and this has caused serious deflation. And this has made enterprises, businesses to have a negative negative perception of the market, so they don't know where the growth point is in the market. A lot of the commercial banks have trouble giving out loans. Last time, our the People's Bank of China have to buy back a lot of its assets. So this kind of decreasing trend or this decreasing speculations has caused has been the cause of China's deflation and economic slowdown. So I hope that everyone can pay more attention to our monetary policy and its impact to the economy of China.
I'm going to ask David, let's talk a little bit about the interaction of the two economies. You know, are you worried about the Fed raising interest rates? Do you think this will have a significant effect on China? Does it complicate things? And just more generally, does the performance of the U.S. economy have a big effect on your reform program and your growth?
Sure. Before coming to this question, I can't help but making an observation, right? Here we have one of the architects of China's reform and the insider of the policy-making community, really well-respected, and he's a good student of Milton Friedman. Twice he came to the U.S. seeking advice from Milton Friedman, the late Milton Friedman. This is highly revealing, you know, for those of you in the media. I guess it's okay, right, to tell. You said this, right? I'm just making comments. Okay. Anyway, coming to the issue of the U.S. Fed, yes, I am a little bit concerned about the eventual hiking of the interest rates of the U.S. because, number one, the market, as you indicated, is unprepared. When I say market, I mean the Wall Street. The Wall Street, and as well as other financial markets all over the world, they are unprepared. So when the hiking actually comes, there will be a shock. That's my reading. The stock price will come down. And that will feed in Chinese stock markets and financial markets. Not that China is needing currency reserves. China has still a tremendous amount of currency reserves, right, to buffer any capital outflow in the current regime of capital account management, right? That the direct impact on China from the U.S. Fed is relatively small. I worry about the indirect impact, that is the channel of expectation, the channel of foreign markets coming down, affecting Chinese markets coming down. So sometimes in China, I joke that usually in autumn, problems happen in the financial markets. You got, you know, yeah, right? The global financial crisis starting September, right, 15th of 08. You've got the long-term capital in autumn. Of course, 9-1-1, different issue, still in autumn, right? So let's be prepared for the big autumn. That's why I ask for
September. That's why they call it fall.
Fall, yes, the fall, the same word. Right. Yeah. Usually summertime is okay, because summertime in the U.S., people are quiet, right? Financial markets are quiet. But China, different. So China, this time around, we got a big fall in the summer, because people tend to move earlier than the rest of the world. Anyway, so yes, to answer your question, I'm worried.
Right. Don, you want to respond a little bit?
Well, I do think it's not an on-off switch. So there may be some surprise. The question is how much surprise. And there's also an issue, I think, of which is kind of implied by what you say, with the rates where they are positions building up that eventually will have to be reversed. And this is controversial in the U.S. Are stocks overvalued? Are bonds overvalued? Is the dollar correctly valued going forward? And no one's really very certain of that. So of what the right answer is there. But if you thought that risky positions were building up, keeping that, I mean, the sooner you got going, probably the smaller the response would be. So that's partly, I think, why Chair Yellen said if we wait, we'll have to be a sharper increase. If we go earlier, it could be a gradual increase. Actually, it's probably better for financial stability to have that gradual increase.
I'm going to ask one more set of questions, then I'm going to turn to the audience so you can be thinking about your questions. But I have a set of questions for the three of you. The concern, and apologies, this is a little bit more of a topic for the next panel, but I want to take advantage of having Mr. Zhang and Don, you know, David and I will both be there for the next panel. It's a question about global economic governance. China would like its currency, the renminbi, to be included in the IMF's SDR. Right. So I want to start with Mr. Zheng, and I'm going to ask Mr. Zheng, so what is China's thinking behind internationalization of the RMB, including it in the SDR? What does China gain out of this? Don, I don't know if you have a view, but I'm going to ask you if you have a view about including the RMB in the SDR this year. Okay. David, of course, you can comment as well. But let's start with Mr. Zheng and internationalization of the RMB.
In order to ensure the stability of the international financial system, I think that we should establish a multilateral, multifaceted monetary system in the world. Currently, the U.S. dollar, as the main reserve currency of the world, has assumed too much responsibility. It went beyond its actual capabilities. If we can establish a system that includes the dollar, the RMB, and the euro, where the three currencies are balancing each other. If one currency rises, people will buy, and if one currency goes down, people will sell them. So in this way, kind of forcing the sovereign government of the currency to stabilize the value of their respective currencies. So this may be one way for us to establish a stable international monetary system. In terms of RMB, at the current stage, it's far from a national currency. Right now, we have done a lot of preparation work for the internationalization of RMB, and the last step is to allow the exchange of capital projects. And it may be implemented very soon. And we've established monetary exchange agreements with many countries. So RMB, in terms of its flow in the international market, in terms of RMB joining the IMF SDR, becoming a member of the SDR, will contribute to the internationalization of RMB. Currently, our proportion in the SDR is too low. The IMF is hoping that we could increase the share of RMB in SDR. I think this is the right position, and the U.S. Congress should back this proposition. Thank you.
Inherently destabilizing to have a multi-reserve currency system with the SDR, with the Chinese yuan, the euro, and the dollar in the foreseeable future? And then if you have an opinion on the SDR.
No, I don't think it's... I know I'm not familiar with this literature, but I do recall reading that there are pros and cons to having a multilateral, multi-dimensional international financial system in terms of the shifting of demands that we were just talking about and how disruptive that could be. I think the most important thing is to have each country, each currency issuer, have sound and good policies and be open, have open capital markets, open financial markets to facilitate the flow of finance around the world to its best uses, to facilitate productivity rising everywhere. And so I think whether there are two currencies, three currencies, etc., is almost secondary to good policies and good policy frameworks and open markets. I don't have a view on whether the RMB is ready to be included in the SDR. My preference would be that the IMF have clear criteria for this inclusion and that they that any currency have to meet those criteria, and I don't know what they are. I think the last point you made about the Congress, and I think you're really referencing the voting shares, and I certainly support, I wish the Congress would pass that bill to reform the voting shares in the IMF, to modernize the governance of the institution. I share your concerns in that regard.
David, you want to weigh in on this? Then I am going to turn to the audience.
Sure. Yeah. Very briefly, I do see long-term benefits for the RMB to be an international currency, not only for China, but also for the world, including the U.S., because we will have more currencies for countries to keep their reserves in, right? There's less burden on the U.S., on the U.S. Fed, right? This is for sure. Also, I myself started my research on the RMB internationalization 6 years before the financial crisis, or 8 years ago. Yeah. But now, after 8 years, I'm becoming more and more cautious on this issue for many reasons. I'm only going to mention two, okay? From the Chinese side, a very rapid internationalization of RMB means that the capital account will be more open, and the recent episode of our stock market volatility shows that we have to be very careful, right? Very, very super cautious in this regard. And also, in addition, on the Chinese side, a rapid internationalization of the RMB means what? Means that the world, all over the world, more and more people will swap their US dollar holding to Chinese RMB holding. The demand for RMB will go up. Therefore, the real exchange rate of RMB will have to, one way or the other, appreciate. Right? A rapid appreciation of the RMB may not be good for the transition of the Chinese economy. So there is a cost issue. Now, this is about China. On the U.S. side, the picture is even clearer. On the U.S., nobody knows what's the impact of having a new international currency on your interest rates of your treasury bond. Let me put it very frankly. The treasury bond. Now your U.S. enjoys super low treasury bond. Maybe 200-year record low, and 300, who knows?
Yeah. Go ahead.
But so that will, no one knows what's the impact. Right. Even with a minor probability of RMB becoming international, causing your treasury bond interest rate to go up, that consequence might be quite impactful. So we have to be careful on this issue. That's the bottom line.
I think it would. There are a lot of portfolio shifts that might occur. I think they would occur slowly over time. And I do think the low rate on the U.S. Treasury bonds reflects primarily the perception that they're risk-free and, of course, the very low global interest rates, including in the U.S., in order to get economies going. I think you've pointed to an important point, though, in your answer, which is people talk about the U.S. as a reserve currency having an exorbitant privilege, as if it's a great thing for the U.S. And I think you're right. There are pros and cons to being a reserve currency. You've just pointed out the cons might be for China. So it's not a black and white thing. It's good. It's bad. It can go lots of different ways.
In other words, the SDR issue in China, we often say this, shouldn't be treated as an Olympic gold medal, right? Don't treat it as a gold medal project. Treat it as a pragmatic thing, right? Be cautious on this issue.
Yeah. I think when the euro was established, people thought that would be a rival for the dollar as a reserve currency. And even before the crisis, I think the shift in reserves was very gradual, and the implications were not that large for either the euro economy or the U.S. economy. But I guess I doubt that the establishment of the RMB would have major negative effects on U.S. bond markets.
Okay, let's turn to the audience. I'd like to take three questions at a time. This gentleman's hand went up first. The microphone is right there. And please identify yourself and ask a question.
Pishu from Voice of America. Yeah, about household registration reform. And Mr. Zheng mentioned that the coastal developed cities in China enjoy the most contribution from migrant workers without distributing benefits to them. Yeah, my question is, if I were such a mayor of such a developed city, yeah, I would like to keep the status quo. That is, I get a free lunch without paying anything. That means here we need a political democratic reform there to put pressure for the, yeah, for the reform. But now it seems that political democratic reform is dead in China, or is at the dead end. So how to get out of this situation? Or do you think there's any way out for this? Thank you.
Okay. As I said, I'd like to take three questions because there's always a chance they link it, and then it gives everyone a chance to respond. I like to try to avoid everybody answering one question because then we just don't get very far. So this gentleman with his hand up there, and then I'll come over to you, and then we'll definitely take another round, okay?
Oh. Yes, I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhary with Pakistan American League. My question is that there's a big trade deficit between USA and China trade. What are the incentives of USA to continue to allow China to have this trade surplus while dealing with USA? Thank you.
Okay, excellent question. I'm going to throw that one to Don. I will get to you, but there was a slight misunderstanding by the mic person. So the gentleman back there,
I'm Tony Kane from American Councils for International Education, not an economist, so my question is not going to be an economics question, but I guess I want to frame it in terms of Mr. Lee's introductory remarks about the, you know, learning from Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me, I see a tendency in China now to be told, if you're going to learn basketball, you have to learn it from Yao Ming.
Oh.
We have to learn from Chinese. I mean, you say there are people here from the Shukuyuan who have been warned about foreign influences. And as a historian, this to me goes back to the Zicang Yundong and the Zhongshui Wei Ti, Xishui Wei Yong. And that never really worked. And as a, you know, obviously I think Americans have their own view, but I'd be interested to hear from a Chinese point of view whether you think this is actually limiting and destructive to the ability to push forward the kind of reforms you really need to succeed.
Okay, good three questions. They actually don't link, but that's fine. Mr. Zheng, first question is for you.
Okay, first of all, so those most developed cities, rather, they should provide public services to the farmers and the workers. And this is already included in the decision of the third plenum, and it has to be implemented. This is only sooner or later when we are going to do that. Now, we have to reform the rural area, and we have to put our focus on the rural area and urbanize our farmers and on our workers. And then for those, the rural housing land can be transferred, and all those other reforms that have to do. And so all those three reforms in the rural areas have to conduct at the same time. So for the farmers to transfer their rural housing land or to rural land to transfer to other collective cooperations, and then to transfer is a rural housing land to then they will, it will gain some wealth in that way. And on top of the affordable housing in the cities, they will be able to buy a housing or to rent an apartment in the cities, and to have the family united in the cities. So to build their city dream. So that very soon that you are going to see such an achievement in China. The second is that the trade deficit or trade deficit between the U.S. and China is because of different factors. Of those factors, if If we have any changes on those factors, it may have some impact and that may affect our trade deficit. But in the foreseeable futures, at least in the next 8 or 10 years, as far as I'm concerned, such kind of a trade deficit will still exist. And such trade exists is because the divisions of a technology that's between U.S. and China, that, for example, that we provide labor-intensive and resources-intensive of a technology. And then the U.S. provide us with also intellectual and technology-intensive technologies. And there is a gap in prices. And for China, that we enjoyed the trade surplus in this transaction. So I think that within 10 years' time, if without any changes on the way we do trade, that the surplus is still going to be present. And such kind of a surplus is beneficial to both countries. American people can enjoy of the cheap products, cheap goods, and the Chinese people with the trade surplus will be able to purchase some of the high technologies from the U.S. But there's going to be one change, that we are going to lower the amount of the treasury bonds that we bought from the U.S. So we are going to change it to direct investment. The direct investment probably is to buy housings in the U.S. And so some of the enterprise or companies that very very innovative, and that we may acquire all those companies as well. So now in U.S. and China, is now negotiating a bilateral investment treaty. We hope that the treaty can be signed as soon as possible, that once this treaty is signed, that it's going to play an important role in reduce the deficit between U.S. and China. And the third is that when we're doing the market economy in the technology part, that the U.S. is the mentor of China. We are like elementary student. That we learned with respect from the U.S. This is my ninth time to come to the U.S., and every single time when I'm here, and I try to learn from your macroeconomics issues, and for example, including the macroeconomic adjustments, that we have learned a lot from the U.S. For example, that we talk about our experiences of how to deal with inflation, that we also learned from the American teachers, American professors. However, after we learn from you, that we still have to go back to China and look at the reality on the ground to combine those together, and so in order to have a successful reform. Last year, the Chinese students, high school students come to the U.S. for college is about more than 200,000. And then for Chinese students go to other, to go off overseas, it's about 460,000. So what does that show? That shows that we are very modest, that because we know that we give to the other people, so that we send a lot of students overseas for them to learn. And so that I think that for the next decades, we still have to be the elementary student to learn from others. Thank you very much.
It's bilateral deficit, trade deficit from China, and you know, why does it allow it to continue? Actually, I like that word allow. Is there anything the U.S. can do to change the situation?
Or anything the U.S. should or China should do to change the situation.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can look at let me pick up on the second set of points that were made, and I agree that there are many reasons in comparative advantage and trade and technology for countries to have deficits and surpluses with each other. And by and large, when the fundamentals and the technology and the relative labor costs dictate those trade flows, both countries benefit. We know that from David Ricardo on forward. Now, what gets to be a problem is if there are artificial barriers to the adjustments of relative labor costs and relative prices. And the perception in the U.S. for a long time was that intervention in the currency markets by China was putting that artificial barrier to true adjustment to the underlying technology and comparative advantage. Now, that has dissipated to a large extent, as I understand it. There's much less intervention today. So I think allowing the RMB to appreciate, allowing market pressures to come to bear on the RMB has been a very positive contribution to global economic stability and global growth. And we shouldn't be focused on a bilateral trade between two countries as long as the underlying policies are right. I mean, China is part of a long set of supply chains, and just focusing on those two numbers isn't really in the interest of either country. The policies are in the interest of either country.
Okay, thank you. David, you want to tackle the last question, which was also commented, or any of the others, but though not at length. And you know, the last question was about this changing attitude in China toward, you know, foreigners, foreign technology, foreign connections. You know, how serious is that? Is that a problem for China continuing to integrate in the world?
I think overall, despite all these very busy comments in the internet, overall, if you talk to people on the street, people in China are still holding, in my view, a consensus that China is still a poor economy, is a poor country. China needs to learn. And there are certain important ingredients among all successful societies. Think tanks are actually important ingredients for that society to function properly. So in this regard, China has to learn from the best practice, right? So Michael Jordan, for sure, is much better basketball player than Yao Ming. Yao Ming got into the every year All-Star because of Chinese voters, right? If you vote among the coaches, for sure, Michael Jordan will be in. Yao Ming, I don't think, will be in the All-Star team, right? Anyway, so coming here, we are learning. We're learning from the best players, right? So I think this attitude is still popular in China. It's still the underpinning of the society. On the issue of U.S.-China trade, I'm optimistic. I would bet in the coming decade, the picture will change for two simple reasons. Number one, Chinese consumption is coming up. By my calculation, it's about 46-47% of the GDP. Not the official one. The official data grossly underestimates our consumption as a share of GDP. And to go with this, wage rates are no longer low. China is no longer cheap. Labor is already become expensive. Here among us, in our delegates, we have the owner of a big construction group, right? Miss Li, she's sitting in the front, second row. Yeah, she's the owner of a big private construction group. She asked me, she told me one year ago, she wants to replace some of her workers by robots, because construction workers are too expensive, right? So what's the implication? The implication is China will buy more stuff. Will produce less cheap stuff, right? Give you one example, one story. Smartphone. We use iPhone, we use Samsung, right? But I tell you, within 1 or 2 years, I bet some of the market shares of Samsung or iPhone will be given away to 1 or 2 Chinese brands, Xiaomi or Huawei. Huawei, a scary name, you know, right? For some Americans. But Huawei is getting into smartphone. Very good. I share no shares of Huawei, okay. Huawei is not listed in the stock market. So honestly, they are upcoming. Why? Very simple. The comparative advantage of Chinese producers of smartphone is that China has the largest market of smartphones. When you have a large market, you can do R&D. You can average down the R&D expenses, and then you can develop. That's why the Germans, even though they are good in making cars, they are not good in making smartphones. Have you heard of a German smartphone? Never, right? There's a reason for that. Anyway, the picture will change within 10 years.
Okay. This gentleman over here I feel this gender imbalance. Are there no women who want to ask questions? But we're going to start with him. I'll come back in a moment. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. I'd like to ask Mr. Jung concerning his comments about the M2 and the restrictive monetary policy. You seem to indicate that you would want a liberalization of monetary policy, of enlargement of M2, if I understand the question correctly. How do you, in that situation, if that is the case, how do you avoid feeding into some of the potential bubbles that exist in China, like in housing or some of the other areas when that policy is implemented? If you could clarify what you said. Thank you.
Okay. This gentleman right here, and then the gentleman, in the slightly back gentleman with the hand up, yeah.
Robert Werner of the Werner Group. This is a question for our Chinese guest. Could you give us a progress report on your government's goal to sharply increase over a period of time consumer spending as a percentage of overall GDP?
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Yeah. And then, see the gentleman there? Yeah.
My name is Yu Chen Yang from Love Funding. I'm pretty happy to hear Mr. Zheng talking about international Chinese international students, because I'm one of them that came in the States in 2009 to experience and learn. Now I'm focusing on the commercial real estate financing. My question is to Mr. Kong regarding the interest rate. So how much has the sharp decline in the energy market, energy price, contributed to the low inflation scenario situation in the States? So once or if or when the energy market, global energy market, stabilizes, are we going to see a very dramatic climb up for the global energy price? And what is that going to impact on the Fed to possibly give more hikes after the initial hike? Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're going to take these in reverse order, so I'm going to ask Don to answer that one.
Okay.
It was very clear. And then, David, I think you're the best person to answer about raising consumption relative to GDP. You already mentioned that. Sure. And then Mr. Jung on monetary policy. But first, Don.
So energy prices have certainly depressed headline inflation, overall inflation in the United States, as they have everywhere, and resulted in mild temporary deflation. It's not really a deflationary situation. It's just a price level adjustment down. The Federal Reserve, correctly in my view, tends to look through those energy prices to look at what's looking at core inflation, which excludes food and energy, but also thinking about the feed through of energy to other prices in the U.S., for example, airline fares, etc., and try and determine what the underlying path of prices are resulting from persistent supply and demand changes. So I think the decline in energy prices has not had a huge effect on monetary policy, and I wouldn't expect a leveling out, which is kind of, there's been a little bit of a rebound in the leveling out, to have a big effect on policy. I think the Fed's trying to look that's more a price level change than a persistent inflation change. The Fed's trying to look through that, so I would downplay the effects of energy prices on Federal Reserve policy, except as they might affect underlying supply and demand in the whole economy and have a persistent effect, say, on inflation expectations, which they haven't done so far.
Okay, David, progress on the government's effort to boost consumption relative to GDP?
Yeah, first of all, there's no explicit target of the government as of the ratio of consumption to GDP. And thanks God, there's no target of this. Because it's almost impossible, I claim, for any government policies to boost that share, because consumption or private consumption is made by hundreds of thousands of households, right? How can you do that? In Hong Kong, in Singapore, they tried to do that. When I was in Hong Kong, actually, government gave us everybody a check, 5,000 Hong Kong dollar, maybe around $600 for us to expand. Most people put the check right away into the bank account, sleeping there, right? So it's impossible to do that, right? Now, very good. The good thing is that, as I already mentioned, wage rates are increasing in China because of relative shortage of labor, blue-collar labor, and therefore disposable income of most households is increasing, and therefore people are able to consume more and more. And as a consequence, consumption as a share of GDP has been steadily increasing ever since 2007. 2007 is the trough. Now it's 47%. So I would say give it 5 years, consumption will be higher than 50%, which is a pretty comfortable figure for a growing economy like China. That's the consumption question. On the issue of M2, Now, I do agree that the current monetary policy in China is too tight, especially facing the prospect of the U.S. Fed hiking interest rates. So in China, I have been proposing our monetary policy to loose a little bit, maybe actually loose, and then waiting for the Fed to hike the interest rate. Then we hike. We go in sync. We don't want to, right? Because when the Fed hikes interest rates, there definitely will be certain pressure for capital to flow out from China to other economies. So China has to be prepared for the U.S. policy change. Now, that being said, let me also mention something else. M2 is no longer as indicative as before. Because why? Because M2 is linked to bank lending. But you know what? In China, there's a fundamental change going on right now. Corporate bonds and municipal bonds are becoming more and more important, which are outside the M2. You know, the Chinese bond market is now number 4, soon to be number 3 in the world in terms of stock. Bond market, most of the bonds are traded in the interbank market, not in the open stock market. So the bond financing is becoming more and more important, replacing bank loans. This is good progress. This is a progress we've been pushing for many, many years. So I agree with Mr. Zhen with all respect. However, the number M2 is not indicative.
Okay, Mr. Zheng.
Can I ask two questions about the consumption thing? So I thought there were two kinds of reforms that would help here. One was the provision of a safety net by the government so that people didn't have to save as much themselves. Yeah. And the second and related one was financial reform. So they had more ability to shift their and more confidence that they could shift their consumption over their lifetime, that they would return get a real rate of return on their savings. So I thought both of those types of reforms would be important to boost consumption.
Good question. I think it's a myth. We did research on this issue, empirical research. We found that, to our surprise, Chinese consumers are much, much less sophisticated than their U.S. counterparts. All they want is cash right now. Cash in hands, salary in hands in their pockets before they want to consume. They don't believe in borrowing money and consuming. They're not American consumers. These are Chinese. Most of them are low-income, blue-collar workers. They would line up in the HR department of, let's say, construction company, saying, don't give us insurance. Give us cash. Cash in hands. We want to opt out in your insurance policy. Right? So this is Chinese consumers. So anyway, this is about economics. You know, economics, I guess, has to be adapted to culture or local situation.
Okay, Mr. Zheng on monetary policy.
I want to provide my feedback to the first and the second question, especially the second one, which is my area of expertise. China's consumption in terms of percent of GDP is 36%. The U.S. is 72%. These represent two poles of world economy. And how do you boost consumption? We have two policies. One is to increase the income of our residents, especially people in the rural areas, the peasants, the farmers. If you look at the most recent 2 years, in terms of the growth rate of our income, resident income, it's faster than GDP growth. And farmers' income, in terms of the growth rate, is faster than urban residents. This has been unprecedented since the beginning of the reform and opening up policy. this means that consumer power will be increased. The second policy measure is that we need to increase the income of farmers and increase their consumption power, because there are over 600 million farmers in China, and their average income and average consumption is only one-third of that of the urban residents. So how do we increase their income? The third plenum has lined out several important policy initiatives, which is to modernize rural economy and to shift the labor to the second and the third industries. We have to encourage the farmers to relocate their parents and their children to the cities to increase urbanization. So this is how we plan to increase rural resident or farmer's income. We have seven cities in terms of, for example, in terms of motor vehicles, we have seven cities in China that are actually limiting the purchase of motor vehicles. But in rural areas, the ownership rate of cars is still very low. In the U.S., every 1,000 person own 800 motor vehicles or cars, and in China that number is only 17. So we have to increase that, for example, so in order to increase consumption. With regards to preventing financial bubbles, overall, I think that the Chinese economy has a little bit of bubble, but that's within the normal range. In the past, we used to talk about the economy being very monetized, because we have over 13 trillion M2, and GDP is lower than that, so the monetization rate is about 200%. But that's the monetization rate is what we've looked at in the past, and we have neglected the real economy. Chinese economy have been dependent too much on direct fundraising from the banks. And that rate is only 30% in China, and in the U.S. is 70%. So total cap of China with relations to the GDP has been 40% in the long term. So overall, the securitization of China is still much lower compared to developed countries. If you look at the U.S., a lot of financial derivatives with high leverage, and in China there's no financial derivatives with and very low leverage. So in that light, under that light, the monetization of our economy, a greater M2 numbers, it's within normal range. It's necessary, it's rational, and it's normal. So China today, in terms of changing the rather tight monetary policy and to loosen up monetary policy, increase the flow of M2, this is a policy measure that meets the current, it's a fundamental measure that's going to deal with the current economic downturn.
And then this other woman standing up over there. Those will be our two last questions, okay?
Thank you. Hi, good morning. My name is Virginia Kutchin. I'm an independent intercultural consultant specializing in China. Thank you all for your presentations. My question is, how does China intend to reconcile its consumption goals with environmental protection and sustainability? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Thank you.
我有一个问题问一下郑先生，因为刚刚您说国企改革的重点是以后从
I have a question for Mr. Zheng. Last week, President Xi Jinping in Yanbian talked about that China's goal is to develop its real economy. I don't know if it's a conflict with your reform goals that you just talked about.
Okay,
我想问一个问题啊，中国政府呢一直在推这个。
I have a question. China has been promoting a PPP project, public and private partnership. So I want to ask our foreign experts if there is any experience that China can learn from the U.S.
Okay, let's. David, you're going to do the how does China reconcile consumption with environment, and Mr. Zheng on the effect of the reforms on the real economy. But,
yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
In terms of SOE reform, shifting from managing asset to managing capital, it's a different matter from whether SOEs spent their capital in real economy or in the financial market. Because in the past, we talked about SOE, we used to refer SOEs as managing the people, managing the asset, and managing the company. So now we would like them to actually move toward managing capital, establishing a corporation that manages the capital, which will control shares of the actual SOEs. And depending on your the shares that this overall management company holds in different SOEs, they will have varying voting rights. So before, the SOEs, you know, if they're involved in the real economy or if they're actually, so that we want withdraw funds from SOEs so that they could invest in the financial market. It's two different matters we're talking about. It's just like in China, we have established the China Financial Corporation. And what it does is that it would hold shares of commercial banks. It does not interfere with the bank's actual operations. So in the future, in terms of managing SOE asset in China, we may actually borrow that model. So in that way, it's actually it will actually contribute to the growth of the real economy. And a lot of the large SOEs may actually become a capital management company. And that's sufficient. So that's my view on it's a great shift in terms of managing SOEs in China. Especially a lot of our SOEs are actually listed in the U.S. American investors are shareholders of our SOEs. And they have to open their books to investors and to be subject to oversight of investors. And these companies are actually internationalized and have become social enterprises. In terms of how do you reconcile the goals of environmental protection and consumption, so the third plenum has decided that we need to establish a ecosystem civilization system. So whoever pollutes, whoever pays. And we want a third party to be overseeing the progress. In the past, we have been lagging in terms of supervision. The businesses who took care of their own pollution, they suffered a loss in their income. But moving forward, we will ask businesses that pollute pay a fine or pay a fee to the government, and the government will then look for a qualified and specialized firm to deal with pollution. So previously our companies would have this pollution control system, and they turn that on during the day and turn it off during the night and turn it on when inspectors came. So now, in the future, we're going to shift that to a third party provider.
I remember, right? Private consumption as share of GDP, according to official statistics, only 36%. But that's grossly, grossly wrong, because Chinese official number relies upon household surveys for consumption. And when they do household surveys, they can only get response from low-income households because they pay people to report the numbers. High-income and busy people would never cooperate. Therefore, they can only account for 50%. One half of all the automobile sales from household surveys. So in my number, in my research, we completely start from wholesale. From retail. We construct our consumption from retail. We took out all those government and enterprise purchase through retail, and then we add back consumption through of service. Then we got a number of 46-47% of GDP as private consumption. That being said, let me tell you a story about consumption. Today's consumption increases mostly the incremental part coming from service, not from material. In China, for example, if you want to treat your guests, that's Friday night, right? What you can do, you can call, pick up the phone, or you can go to the internet. You say, I want Sichuan-style food. Somebody will send you a chef, right? If you don't trust their food, you can call internet delivery of your food, and the Sichuan chef will cook it for you on the spot, and then lay the table and leave. And then you call them, they come in to wash dishes. This is Chinese new consumption, mainly in service, not really the materials. So consumption is changing, service is becoming more important, and consumption increase and sustainability, environmental protection, they are going the same hand.
Okay. Don, I actually can answer the question on PPP unless you would like to.
Over to you, David.
I'll just briefly say on the public-private partnership. I mean, the phrase is vague and covers a lot of different things. But, you know, in my time in the World Bank, we were primarily interested in public-private partnerships in infrastructure. And you can find quite a few good examples in the United States, and the World Bank has a lot of successful cases. The basic principle is to separate, you know, the kind of public goods that only the government can do or sort of natural monopoly functions, and then, you know, try to carve out space where the private sector can compete, you know, for power generation, for example. You separate distribution from generation so private companies can compete in generation, whereas distribution is a natural monopoly. The U.S. has a pretty good track record, but recently the problem in the U.S. is our total infrastructure spending has just declined quite dangerously. So we only spend 1.7% of GDP on infrastructure. Part of that is just political differences on exactly this issue. You could take a very extreme view that you can leave almost everything to the private sector. You can take the other view that everything should be done by the government. I feel like we used to have a workable compromise in the middle, but it seems to have broken down in practice. So there's some good historical examples, but right now I don't think you'd look at U.S. infrastructure looking for good examples. Anyway, let me just say, I really, as the moderator, I think I can say I really thought this was an outstanding panel, and we're just very fortunate to have these three participants. I'm going to end this just a minute or two early so we can have a nice tea coffee break and resume at 11 o'clock, where we've got really excellent group that will be talking about global economic governance, China's role in the evolving global system. Is there competition between the U.S. and China in a disruptive way in this global system? We touched on a little bit of that, but this was really mostly about the economies of the two countries. Let's give them a big round of applause.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, I suggest we resume momentarily. We have a high standard to follow up set by David Dollar, right? In the last session, you were extremely effective and efficient. I get the Michael Jordan standard, right? being able to score in a short period of time. And now in this session, we have very distinguished panelists discussing the global governance and China's role in that important issue. And to my right, we have local. Right, we have a senior research fellow here, Ambassador Bader, who has had this very long distinguished public service career in the U.S., being ambassador for the U.S. and also senior director of the National Security Council under President Clinton, I think, right?
Under Obama.
Director under Clinton. And also he's a wonderful expert scholar on China. He's really a China hand, and people from China know him very well. And to his right, we have Mr. Gao Xiqing, who is the former CEO of China's Sovereign Wealth Fund, the China Investment Corporation, CIC. And also, he was one of the architects of China's stock exchanges. Before that, he was trained in graduate school at Duke, as a lawyer, and not many legal students studying law returned to China. He was very few legal experts in China, knowing both sides, both the Chinese legal practice and the U.S. legal practice. To his right needs no introduction, David Dollar, who is also has a long and distinguished career serving not only the U.S. but also the World Bank, right? And an old friend of mine, and one day he called upon a big party, a farewell party, in China, in the great venue, saying that he is retiring from the World Bank, being the resident chief. And a few months later, he showed up again in Beijing, saying that he became the newly appointed special emissary. Did I pronounce it right? Emissary of the Treasury Department. I was very surprised. I went home, I checked my dictionary. I found a special word in Chinese means secret agent. Secret ambassador. I said, are we at war with each other? We don't need a secret ambassador. So he was responsible for the China-U.S. relationship, economic relationship, during the most interesting times after the global financial crisis. So I don't think we can get a better panel to discuss this issue. Let me start with Ambassador Bader. What do you think of the AIIB? Is it publicly recognized in the U.S. that the U.S., the White House or Treasury made a mistake? What's the long-term implication of this episode for the U.S. policy towards China on global issues?
I'm hoping there will not be long-term implications from it because clearly it was mishandled by someone in the administration. The administration properly had some concerns about the governance standards, procurement issues, environmental standards, voting share issues, and the administration was right to encourage others to raise those issues with the Chinese organizers of the bank, but the administration should not have done so with the spirit of trying to kill the bank. It should have done so in the spirit of trying to improve the standards that would be imposed. Of course, the chairman of the bank is, is Jin Li-chun, who's prominent, well-regarded, well-respected in international circles and in the U.S., and he is someone that I think that that all of us can work with. I think the Chinese, frankly, were shocked that they got 57 countries to join. I don't think that was ever the expectation. The thing
was U.S. shocked by that. Was U.S. also shocked?
I think U.S. was shocked too. Sure. I think, clearly from the outset, the U.S. strategy was misguided. The region needs infrastructure. Okay, for the U.S. To oppose a bank that was designed to create infrastructure puts us really in an untenable position vis-a-vis other countries in the region that want infrastructure. If we're telling them, sorry, we can't help you with your infrastructure, but don't go to that bank because we don't like its organizers, that's not a tenable position. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that what Jin Li-chun and the Chinese leadership were trying to do here was entirely consistent with the strategy of the U.S. outlined at the beginning of the Obama administration, which was to encourage rising powers, principal among them China, to play a larger role in international institutions, consistent with reasonable global norms. And it seems to me that's what the Chinese were doing in this instance. So the reaction of the administration should have been to encourage it and to try to provide the best standards for the bank.
Yeah, I try to be fair to President Obama. Should I blame the U.S. Congress? Because the U.S. Congress is shadow over the White House, so that if the White House or Treasury had decided to join the AIIB, the Congress would go after the administration. Can I say that?
There's never any question that the U.S. joined in. There's no way the Congress would have approved it in any case. The question really was the U.S. going to discourage other major countries from becoming members? And the administration says it did not. Its behavior was universally interpreted by the media as opposition, and if that was not the administration's policy, frankly, they should have issued a clarification,
What's
which
next?
I never did.
what's the next move of the U.S.?
I think the administration understands it made a mistake, okay? And I think
without publicly recognizing it, right?
Well, the countries aren't great at admitting mistakes, you know. We have the Donald Trump model now. But I think, you know, we can acknowledge it was a mistake. Governments aren't that good at acknowledging it. But I think the administration is looking for ways to connect with the bank, perhaps through encouraging the World Bank and the ADB to work with AIB. Perhaps the administration at some point may decide on a more direct relationship with AIB, but actual membership, I think, is not on the horizon. But there's no reason why it should be viewed hostily. I mean, President Obama, at a press conference, when was it, during his trip in November, mm-hmm. made positive statements about the AIB, and I think that's where the administration is heading and should be heading.
Today we are very fortunate to have a person who was responsible for the idea of AIB, Mr. Zheng Xinli, who was in the previous panel. A few years ago, he persistently proposed this idea of AIB to then President Hu Jintao 6 times in a row. And for whatever reason, Hu Jintao did not take his proposal. And then came President Xi Jinping, who took it. So later on, I will ask Mr. Zheng Xinli to make some comments. Now let's move to our good friend David Dollar. You worked for the World Bank. You're very familiar with all these international organizations. My question is, what's next? Next, China working with India, working with Russia, will set up the new BRICS investment bank. What would be the U.S. response to that, taking lessons from the AIB?
Right. So I was enthusiastic about the launch of the AIB, and I've been an informal advisor to them.
Yeah.
You know, Jinli Chun and the Secretariat staff he has working for them came out of the Ministry of Finance of China, and they've been working with the World Bank for decades, to be perfectly frank. You know, and I think we had a very good working relationship. They've called on 8 different retired World Bank staff, as far as I count, to help them with some of the initial, you know, the initial setup. So I was enthusiastic about AIB, and it's very successful. I'm a little bit confused about the BRICS Bank. I feel like AIB was a very clear concept, so congratulations to Mr. Zheng. I don't think BRICS Bank is such a clear concept. You know, those 5 countries are enormously different. You know, the difference between China and South Africa is just enormous. If the idea is to just lend to that group of 5, it's kind of a strange group. And if the idea is to lend to the whole world, then I would think, well, typically in development banks, you know, you want to join and be a shareholder if you're going to borrow. So is the idea that the whole world can join? So I guess I don't see such a clean concept coming from the BRICS. But as far as how the U.S. reacts, I think, you know, Jeff Bader and I think can agree that we would hope the U.S. would learn from the poor diplomacy it exercised on AIB and at least be more open and see how this new BRICS bank develops.
You disclosed yourself moments ago that you were an advisor, even though informal, to the Chinese government or AIB as an entity, right? Actually, we met each other 1 month ago. 1 month ago, right? In Beijing, when the AIB was formally launched. Can you share with us some insights on the internal working of the AIIB?
Well, I think what would be interesting for the audience is just to follow up briefly on this point that, you know, Jinli Chun and his secretariat, they have decades of experience with the World Bank. Mostly, I think that was positive. China's been one of the largest borrowers from the World Bank. We've had a lot of successful projects. The type of projects evolved over time. So when I was country director, the focus was mostly on environmental projects during the 2000s. China is still a big borrower, and my understanding is they've increased their borrowing from the World Bank in the last few years. For example, they've got Chinese cities asking the World Bank to help clean up air pollution, for example. So first point is, I think the basic relationship between China and the World Bank has been very good. But second point was, the World Bank's not perfect, the Asian Development Bank's not perfect. So I think the Chinese, you know, were legitimately frustrated with various things. And so people like Jinli Chun, you know, were always urging the World Bank to be faster and more efficient and also to put a focus on growth and infrastructure. So China's become a very vocal participant within the World Bank, which I think is healthy. So it's not that surprising, you know, that China would put this focus on the infrastructure in developing the new bank. And I see it as part of this global system, you know, in the sense that it can, you know, healthy competition between the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the World Bank will be a good thing. Mr. Jin and Mr. Kim of the World Bank, I think they had Chinese characters to say for their two last names, right? So they were on the front page of China Daily the other day. World Bank President Kim was in Beijing talking to Jimmy Chun about possible collaboration. Yeah. So my view is a little bit of healthy competition is a good thing because none of these banks has it perfect. But I predict we'll see some good cooperation between AIB and the other banks.
I think I saw you in Chinese primetime TV, 7 p.m., I think every day, over 100 million people watched. I think I saw you shaking hands with President Xi Jinping in after the formal lunch, right? What are the
No. So there you're making a mistake, because I didn't want to be involved in the formal launch, because I think it's legitimate for researchers.
Yeah.
You know, if India came to me and asked for advice about various things that I think I have expertise in, I'd be happy to give India advice. So I was happy to give advice to the secretariat, but I was actually not involved in the launch.
I think there's a formal ceremony of the launch, right? You were there, right?
No.
Anyway, you appear in Chinese TV quite a lot.
I'm more of a backdoor kind of person.
More effective than appearing on TV, right? Yeah. Anyway, what are the things you can share with us which are not written about in the open press about the AIIB leading towards the formal launch? If possible.
Well, I don't know to what extent it's been written, but I thought it was interesting that secretariat, you know, which is all Chinese initially, they invited 8 different retired World Bank staff, 7 of whom were Americans, to come and advise on the articles of agreement, the environmental safeguards, the social safeguards, procurement, governance. Now, advising, that doesn't mean they necessarily took our advice, but I thought that, you know, reflected a high degree of trust between that Chinese secretariat that was developing AIIB. And these are all retired staff of the World Bank, so they don't have any official status. But if you've worked in the World Bank for 20-plus years, presumably you're supportive of a lot of what the World Bank is doing. So I thought the storyline about AIIB challenging the existing order, I just thought that was mistaken right from the start and seemed ironic when so many of us World Bank people were working with the new secretariat to try to establish the bank.
What is the single most important thing that the AIIB can improve upon the World Bank?
This is a really tough question because the AIIB will have standards on paper that look very similar to the World Bank. I predict their environmental standards and social standards will be very similar. Their articles of agreement are very similar. But a lot really depends on implementation on the ground. You know, so how do you respectfully analyze environmental impacts and factor that into decision making, but not become paralyzed and inactive. So I my own main criticism of the World Bank is I think it's gotten so risk averse that it doesn't like to take any chances. And that's really a mistake for a development bank. You have to take chances. Remember, if you don't do the projects, people remain poor, people remain hungry, so there's a risk of not doing projects. But then, of course, if you do any big infrastructure project, there are environmental risks, there are social risks. So I think finding that balance on the ground is going to be the main challenge. And as a social scientist, I'm going to be just interested to see, you know, are they very successful? It'll take a number of years before we can say that.
Let's move to Mr. Gao Xiqing. You were the former CEO of CIC, China's sovereign wealth fund. Will there be collaboration between CIC and AIIB? I know there's already one. Jin Lichun used to be your, what do you call it, supervisory committee chairman, right? A risk control management chairman, right? There's already collaboration. Will there be more collaboration?
That I really don't know. Because, you know, it's a CIC is a sovereign wealth fund, and AIIB is a multinational organization, and by definition, AIIB would have to cooperate with a lot of different government agencies, a lot of different countries and sovereign wealth fund. But recently, CIC has spun off one of its major departments, which is the direct investment department, into a separate company. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of it. It's called, now it's called different names, but overall it's called You know, CIC has a subsidiary called CICC. Now they have this one. It's called CICCC. We all started laughing, but it's a CIC international, cross-border direct investment corporation. So this spin-off is going to be concentrated mostly on direct investment in these countries involved. Mm-hmm. And one of the major functions of this new company is going to be infrastructure investment. So in that regard, I would certainly guess that we would cooperate. But it's not for a policy issue. It's just just by logic.
You were the CEO of China's largest government-owned investment company operating overseas. From your experience, can you share with us whether China is ready in putting together AIIB and other investment entities going out? Is China ready? What are the challenges?
Well, this is... to me, this is not a real question because, you always have these internationalizations bringing up. Was the world ready for a World Bank, when it was formed? So China, of course, is not ready for a lot of things. But China, develops, despite of all these, inadequate preparations. So I would say today China is more ready than any time in the past 30 years to start something like the AIIB. And especially if you look at China, I think China is more ready for AIIB than for CIC because, CIC was a new organization that was very different from all the past 30 years of overseas effort to invest in various countries by the Chinese state-owned enterprises. Mostly at the time when China started doing this 30 years ago, we had CITIC. Then we have all the major state-owned foreign trade companies. Those companies were very much, filled with young staff who had not very much of experience in investing abroad. With the exception of a few much older people over 60, 70, and started doing that. But today, if you look at China, if you look at all these companies, every company is filled with young professionals, mm-hmm. being trained in international relations, like the IMF, like the World Bank, like all the major investment banks. But CIC, when we first started in 2007, we tried to recruit people from these organizations, and that was a time difference. There was especially a cultural difference that was a challenge for CIC to try to manage these people. But for AIIB, this is a 57 country venture, and it's, from day one, you are market oriented, you are supposed to pay market rate, you are supposed to recruit people from all over the country. CIC never had that luxury. We were trying to do that, but we always had some constraint. So I think AIIB is already in that regard.
What were your major frustrations or challenges being CEO of CIC?
Well, there was a lot. But
major ones. Major ones.
Well, I would probably rank that, for the probably outside. It's politically more correct by saying that we were faced with a lot of resistance from various countries. I did have to visit all the capitals of the major countries, including this one, and I had to deal with the CFIUS issue many times. I had to deal with state leaders all the time, trying to explain to them, to try to tell them that CIC is just another company, and we're a profit-making company. We do not have ulterior political motives to take over your resources or steal your trade secrets. But constantly we have to deal with that, and constantly we were frustrated by the various government agencies in our efforts to invest in those countries. But that's just part of it. Overall, as a state-owned enterprise, you have all the constraints of a state-owned enterprise, especially in China over the past 10 years. when, you know, state enterprises are growing and they're getting stronger and stronger, and the government functionality is changing. And in many ways, it moved away from an earlier trend of going in the market direction. Sometimes it's, you know, regressed in terms of dealing with the market, with the people, you know, the way you pay people, the way you try to retain people, the way you try to motivate people to work on market environment. So that's you know, huge frustration. But at the same time, I would have to say that compared to many institutions I worked before, you know, in China, some of which were all state enterprises, and compared to all the state enterprises in China that I'm familiar with, CIC is a much more market-oriented organization, and CIC is, as of today, still filled with people hired from the market, and it has a certain culture there that would allow people to make decisions mostly on market considerations. I wouldn't say 100%.
Good. So it looks like investing in the Blackstone is the easy one. You didn't have to deal with the surface, right? I'm joking. Anyway. Oh. Anyway. Oh, okay. One more question before I come back to Ambassador Bader. The stock market. Are you surprised by this tremendous fall being the architect of the stock markets? I'm talking about the recent downfall.
From my point? Well, the recent stock market crash really is not as much of a crash if you look at only the financial figures. Because you all know, over the past 6 months, the Chinese stock market increased to the highest point, it was over 110%. And the so-called crash only slashed that one-third. You know, we only came down by 30-some%. So, by definition, you know, you wouldn't call that. That's, you know, with such a huge jump, mm-hmm. it's almost by definition that it has to come down somewhat.
80% up, then 30% down.
Right. Yeah. So that should not be by itself a problem. The problem is the kind of fear, the kind of panic that was producing at the time within a very short period of time. In my observation, it's only within probably about 2-3 days. All of a sudden, everyone in the market got panic. Why? You know, this is a very strange issue, because when people ask me, I said, because I personally don't play in the market. I stir fry in the market. I'm not a gambler. I never intended to create a casino. But
you didn't.
But the issue is, because I'm very familiar with the rules, the ostensible rules written on the books, but somehow people come to me and said, look, this is crashing. Why? Because everyone is on margin, and most people are on very high margin. I said, how can that be possible? Because the rules would allow only 50% margin. It's one-to-one sort of borrowing, and which is a new phenomenon in the Chinese stock market over the past 20-some years. Because over the years, we never allowed margin. And then in the effort by the regulators to boost the market enthusiasm, and also in effort by some of the, I don't know which government agencies, to try to tell people that this country is going into a new normal, and the market is going to go on a slow bull market for a very long time, you know, as sort of advocated by various state agency, news agencies, and some of which are probably represented here. And people are saying, no, the market is really going well, and there's no way the market is going to come down. That's, you know,
that's a mistake in your view,
no,
right?
Well, I wouldn't say, you know, people make mistakes all the time. The thing is, the government's function. Because people say, well, during your days, the government also did some stupid things by trying to come out on, people's daily editorial talking about the market. I said, well, at least there's one difference at the time. Twice during Mr. Zhu Rongji's time, we commented on the market because the market was going way too high. This is like, Bob Shiller's irrational exuberance that the market was really going too fast, too high. And the government gets a little nervous and say, okay, if the market goes that high, then eventually it has to come down. So let's say something to bring the market down. Even at the time, I was against the way the government comes out and tell people that, oh, you shouldn't invest in the market. But that's, at least it's better than the time when the government actually comes out and said, okay, everyone go into the market. Let's play it. Let's gamble.
Sure. Do you agree? Do you think the current policy of propping up the stock index justifiable from your legal economic perspective?
It's legal issues are always separate because laws are always created with the intention of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. That's typically in a Marxist theory. But from the what we would call market oriented system, where at least the Communist Party, 18th Party Congress said that the Chinese economy should be, decided much more on the market force rather than anything else. We say let the market be the decisive force of allocating resources. In that regard, then the government, in a market economy, the government should not do that much in the market telling people which way to go, because the market has a what we would call the random walk theory, where people will make their own decisions. We let the invisible hand of the market do it, but somehow we have this visible hand. In Chinese, we say, 闲不住的手. The government has
busy
this hand
yeah.
that's so busy doing everything in the market.
Right.
And by doing that, you do yourself in. That's the most that's difficult part. Even though I understand the way, as a parent, I understand the way that a parent sees his or her children, if they make stupid mistakes, the parents always try to come out and say, okay, don't do that. But now I realize, with a very painful experience, that by doing that, you actually are counterproductive. My son doesn't talk to me anymore. So this is what happens with the, my son is only 16 years old, but the Chinese market is almost 30 years old now. That's the issue. And the market actually is, as a whole, much smarter than any government. That I truly believe. So for the government to come out and say, okay, market is too high, don't go in. Okay, the market is too low, go in. It's really counterproductive. Mm. But at the time when the market actually starts to have panic, when the market really starts technically coming down fast, then the government will have to do something. I'm not in agreement with a lot of my friends who are saying, okay, the government has done something stupid, they shouldn't do anything. I said, no, when the market goes down that fast, that, in those 2 days, if you don't do anything, then the market is going to overcorrect, going down further,
yeah.
And that would have a major dampening effect for future development. Therefore, I say, okay, by that time, it doesn't really matter. Any government, the U.S. government did something, the European government did something, all during financial crisis.
Yeah. We'll come back to this issue. Now, I, as a boring economist, let me ask a question for Ambassador Bader. Suppose there's an index of how much integrated the Chinese are in the global governance system, ranging from 0 to 100. 100 being like U.S., fully integrated, 0 being like maybe North Korea. Where is today's China?
Do I have to start with a number or can I finish with a number?
No, a boring economist. Yeah, number is easy for us, right?
I think it's that's a fascinating question. I think if you look at China over the last 30, 40 years, what you saw from 1978, from the third plenum, until recently was sort of increasing Chinese integration into the institutions of global governance. And that is true both on the security side and on the economic side. On the security side, things like the IAEA and, of course, the UN Security Council at the beginning of 1971, all the various non-proliferation treaties and regimes, various regional organizations, ASEAN Regional Forum. So on the security side, fairly extensive. Mm-hmm. On the economic side,
80. Sorry,
I'll get to your number.
Okay,
I'm not far from your number.
Okay.
On the economic side, I think it's an interesting picture because I think there was, of course, China's integration into the global economy has mm-hmm. been considerable, if, you know, very substantial. But in terms of the institutions, yes, you know, WTO, IMF, World Bank, certainly China in the 1980s made decisions on these major organizations. But there was a certain line that China did not cross in terms of integration, and which the U.S. and the West kind of did not encourage them to cross. Mm. And that was things, the OECD-related institutions, the OECD-related institutions and the G7. And the OECD, as you know, compiles the statistics and does research and provides sort of guidance to major industrial democracies. It also, you have to be an OECD member to be in the International Energy Agency. Coordination of export credit finance bodies throughout the world, it is sort of subsidiary or it's a function of the OECD. The OECD sets standards for global development mm-hmm. agencies, and because the OECD has in its charter that you have to be, quote, an industrial democracy mm. to be a member. The United States and the other members of the OECD kept China at arm's length, and China, for its part, I think still had a strong residual sense that it was a developing country and didn't belong in the OECD anyway. Mm. And so by the time we got to the last few years when China became the second largest economy in the world, and the extent of China's critical role in maintaining and encouraging global prosperity became evident, China was only partially integrated into a lot of these institutions. And I think that that's the backdrop mm. for decisions like AIB and One Belt, One Road and the BRICS Bank, was that China was not, you know, not fully mm. not 50? Fully integrated. So, so I'm getting around to your answer. I'd say something like 70.
70,
something
not
like
bad.
70. I mean, that's both security and yeah. economic. I'd say something in that yeah. range.
Not bad, because at Tsinghua, 60 is pass. Higher than 60.
Low standards.
Low standards. Okay.
Not passes.
Yeah, okay. Now, moving forward, who should be the key? The U.S. be less protective or China be should be more active, would be more proactive? Who is the key player now in order for China to be more integrated in the global governance system?
Okay. I mean, some of this is just structural, okay? China is, you know, the second largest economy in the world. At some point before too long, likely to be the largest economy in the world. Major, you know, going to be the number one trading economy in the world, and one of the leading investment economies in the world. There's no question of the United States or other countries sort of defining China's role. It's you can't define the role of an actor that's it's so substantial. But look, as I said, President Obama at the beginning of his administration talked about our institutions accommodating rising powers. And I think that was a good concept. I think that, you know, the U.S. fell short in blocking, for instance, the alteration, the reform of IMF quota shares, and, you know, it's been stuck in the House of Representatives since 2010. I think that's an example of the kind of thing that that we can't do. On the other hand, there, you know, clearly there's, you know, Mr. Gao Xicheng talked about the problems he encountered with CFIUS. There clearly is anxiety in the United States and a lot of other Western countries about some of China's trade and investment practices. We all know, we've known for years about IPR issues exacerbated by the cyber dimensions of IPR issues. Now with China's a major outward investor, you know, $13 billion a year in the U.S. in the last couple of years, issues about the degree to which Chinese companies, particularly state-owned enterprises, are subsidized in their outward investments and whether or not they're benefiting from an unlevel playing field on their investments. You remember the whole controversy over CNOOC and Unical, over the many elements to it, but the element I think that was most damaging to the bid was the subsidies provided by the China Development Bank, Exim Bank. Mm-hmm. I think I think it's both sides. That's a cop-out answer, but it's the correct answer. I think China, it's important for China to increasingly demonstrate that it's playing by global rules on all these issues. Look, I was involved in the negotiation of China's accession to the WTO, and there was strong language in there about disciplining of state-owned enterprises, about the need for state-owned enterprises to operate by commercial standards. I mean, that's a basic principle of the WTO and the WTO accession. But there's still, you know, despite the progress that's been made in that regard, there's still a long way to go before I think the United States and other countries are comfortable that Chinese state-owned enterprises are operating by commercial principles.
Okay, I really need to open up the floor for questions. But before that, can Ambassador Bader be very brief in answering my following question? Looking beyond the Obama administration, will there be major shifts or changes in the U.S. policy towards China?
My own opinion is that from the U.S. perspective, despite much of the recent dramatic commentary about China's rise and the need for the U.S. to basically throw out the old, you know, blueprint for how we handle relations, that will not be the approach taken by a future president. Look, we have, you know, eight presidents since President Nixon, who many of whom have campaigned on different platforms with regard to China. President candidate Reagan, candidate Bill Clinton, candidate George W. Bush. But if you look at where those presidents all ended up on China policy, they're all within the same parameters. And it's because there are objective realities about the U.S.-China relationship, about the degree to which we are interdependent. That's a word that's used more and more, I think, properly to describe the relationship. So I think there's right now there's not a great mood in the United States towards China, and I think that the U.S. and China mirror image each other. When there's not a good mood in one country, there's not a good mood in the other country, and that is a reality. I think a lot of it has to do with security issues more than economic issues. But, you know, we're condemned to live together and to be interdependent. To expect a new president to sort of throw things out, I don't see that.
Good. Thank you. Word of calm. Okay. Floor is open. Please identify yourself. Be very brief. We started with the lady, okay? Reverse the first panel.
Thank you very much. My question is about the...
You're from?
I'm Zhu Xiaoo from Montreal Institute of International Studies. My question is about how can China deal with the challenges in the globalization? Because in recent years, I've seen a lot of Chinese business utilizing development financing to expand overseas market, which is healthy. But however, at the same time, in many post-conflict countries, especially in Asia and Africa, the distributive justice mechanism is yet to develop to include all the stakeholders into agenda, especially the small and the medium enterprises, conflict-affected ethnic groups. So as a result, the foreign capital flows from China and from the West sometimes re-stimulate the conflict. And jeopardize the debt sustainability.
Okay, I think we got your question.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Next, our friend from Pakistan. We got a card. Please, yeah.
Thank you very much. I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhary with the Pakistan American League. My question is pertaining to this fact that USA is having security pacts with so many countries all around China. And always it is said here that we are doing many good things to protect our interests, our allies and our friends and shipping lanes. We have never heard from China side if they have some friend in the world or if they have some allies in the world. And how come there's such a big gap here? After all, China is also not only busy in building infrastructure, they are trying to be part of globalization. They are involving international affairs. They are becoming global players. But they have never mentioned any ally or a friend in the world.
Thank you. I think Pakistan is oftentimes described as all-weather friend, right? Okay. One more question before we have our panelists answer. Okay, how about to my right? A gentleman.
Thank you so much. My name is Daisuke Igarashi from Japanese newspaper Asahi Shimbun. I have a question on trade. So Japan and the U.S. and other 10 countries are going to meet in Hawaii next week, try to close a deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So my question is, what kind of impact will it have if they can reach an agreement on Chinese policy, including trade? And also, what kind of implication it might have on economic and security sphere in Asia-Pacific region? Thank you.
Very timely question. Please, free pickup. You may want to start.
Well, I'll be brief on. I think that my colleagues can comment better than I can on the economic issues, but just on China's allies. China has historically not believed in alliances. That's not part of their approach to foreign policy. I mean, their one, I guess, formal alliance, North Korea, is an alliance that China has watered down to almost non-existence now. It's not an ally China wants. Relationship with Pakistan comes close to being an alliance. But China, you know, historically has deemed alliances to be relics of, you know, of the Cold War, illustrations of Cold War thinking. I think there's been some low-level discussion in China about should we be seeking allies, but I don't think that that's seriously altered China's basic approach, which is we want to be friends with everyone, we want to have good relations with everyone, military alliances. Look, I mean, China has not stationed troops abroad. I mean, an important part of the U.S. alliance system our security guarantees and basing troops abroad. China's never done that. So that's just not part of China's thinking. Will it be in 10, 20 years? We'll see. I don't think China's moving rapidly in that direction.
TPP? Comments?
I guess the only comment is that I certainly hope it'll be wrapped up in Hawaii. If it's to be wrapped up in time to avoid it becoming a campaign issue, given the timelines for approval, for publication and approval, it's got to be wrapped up pretty soon. And once it becomes a campaign issue, that's not good for TPP.
September, so, December, what is timeline?
I think the hope is if it can be wrapped up in July, that, you know, sometime in the fall, late fall, maybe October, November, it might be ready for a vote. But look, TPP was not about China. It was never about China. I mean, it was about setting standards for a small group of countries in the region. It was not supposed to have a security dimension. It was not supposed to be about China. People ask why China isn't in it. There was never a question of China being in it. It was about a small group of countries that were trying to eliminate trade barriers among themselves, and the U.S. joined, and then the key country to join subsequently was Japan. But I certainly hope with whatever comes out, the door will remain open for China in the future for China to be a member. We should not be descending into exclusive trade blocks on the region. China's negotiating RCEP. I hope both mechanisms will remain open to the other side.
David?
No. Xiqing.
Okay, I would like to comment on your statement about TPP. That it's not, it was never intended against China, but this is not the popular view in China right now, with the heightened nationalism and also the populist movement there. We constantly read, not only, you know, from the internet, but really from many of the major mainstream papers, that TPP seems to be in direct competition with the Chinese effort to set up either the AIB or the BRICS Bank and all these things, and people constantly come out and said, okay, you know, every time there's anything that's negative about it, TPP, people say, oh, that's great to see they're not doing it well because people don't like it. Or people basically saying that China, a small percentage of voices will say, okay, let's try to join them. And most people say, forget it. They don't like us anyway. They're not going to allow us to do anything there anyway. So I think I'm not saying that's the truth, but the thing is, you have to be aware of the sort of popular sentiment in China now, that many people just view it as some sort of effort to block China out of it.
Yeah. In China, TPP is reviewed, is perceived as a rule change, like the rule change of free flow in NBA, where China is Shaquille O'Neal being the largest importer and exporter in the world. And Shaquille O'Neal is not consulted when NBA is changing the free floating rule while others are being consulted, Michael Jordan stuff. So this is kind of strange, right? Anyway, it's an observation. David.
Oh, can I pick up on that analogy?
Please.
So Shaquille O'Neal can slam dunk from in close to the basket, right? So I agree. Yeah. China's the Shaquille O'Neal of manufacturing trade.
Yeah.
And the new agreement is primarily about services trade. It's more like the three-point line, okay? So Shaquille O'Neal probably doesn't care if they push the three-point line back another foot or two. Doesn't matter for him. He never took a three-pointer, I think, in his career. So I do think it's new issues that are really important to the United States and the partners that Jeff mentioned. You know, opening up trade and opening up investment, trade and services investment. I hope China, you know, sees that this is in China's interest as well. Maybe first step is the bilateral investment treaty, but that will be an important part of TPP is the investment agreement. But I really hope China sees the positive benefit.
The problem is that when you say China sees it, which part of China sees it? You know, there's no doubt that the government itself is smart enough to see that.
Right.
The problem is that the government now is no longer able to make decisions in camera. You know, you can no longer make decisions. Say, okay, just by these people, and we're going to sign this. WTO, you guys just follow it.
Right.
Today, you know, no government in China now can just do that anymore because people are more and more aware of their own, you know, voices.
They're making noise everywhere. But you know, in the United States, it's hugely controversial. So if this actually gets implemented and eventually passed and implemented, that'd be a huge political success. You have to bring people along, which is a very difficult issue.
But you guys are used to controversies over the past 200 years. We're not. You know, we are just beginning to do that. So you have to be, you know, on the understanding side of it.
David, I'd like to say, China has a lot of free trade agreements in the region. The U.S., the TPP is not the first free trade agreement in the East Asia region. China has negotiated quite a few of them, and now, as I say, they have RCEP. And the U.S. was not invited into any of these free trade agreements that China negotiated. So I'm not altogether clear why, when the United States is negotiating one, this is seen as anti-Chinese, but when China is negotiating these agreements, it's not seen as anti-American. I mean, I was in the administration, in the Obama administration, when in the early stages of discussing TPP, which is something that we inherited in a smaller form, more modest form from the Bush administration. And I was never at a meeting where there was discussion about, you know, let's figure out how we can construct a trade bloc that excludes China. Mm-hmm. China was not under discussion. What was under discussion was, frankly speaking, the fact that at the outset of the Obama administration, there wasn't much of a trade policy. It was not a high priority for the Obama administration. And within the Obama administration, there were a number of us who felt that trade should be a priority. That would include people like Tom Donilon, for example, at the National Security Council. And so the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And TPP got some attention because we were looking for a trade policy. It wasn't about China. It was about trade. I certainly understand Gao Xicheng's point, and I think the way in which the agreement has been sold politically sort of reinforces understandable suspicions in China that this is aimed or directed at China. But that was in no way the intention.
I think we barely have time to squeeze in another round of questions.
Actually, we're going to go to 12:30.
Oh, 12:30. Good.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. Wonderful. Plenty of time. Now, big relief. Okay. Wonderful. Three questions. Let's start with this young gentleman.
Hi. My name is Ben. I'm a researcher with Eurasia Group. And my question is for Professor Gao. Do you think that the government intervention in the stock market correction could have an implication for China's financial reform agenda, especially towards establishing the equities market as a viable platform for corporate financing?
Good. Very good question.
Good question.
Lady, to my right.
Jane Perlis. New York Times.
Hi, I'm Jane Perlez from the New York Times. I'd just like to ask about the birth of AIIB. What was it that made Xi Jinping choose to go ahead with AIIB rather than Hu Jintao? Because after all, some of the same circumstances were still existing. Huge deficit in infrastructure. China was still out in the cold on the IMF reform. And maybe Zhong Xinli wants to say something.
Good question. Yeah, I got it. Yeah. Okay. One more question from there. I think a student from St. Louis, right? Oh.
Yeah, thank you so much to all four of the speakers. My name is Ryan Mickelson from Washington University in St. Louis. Right. Ambassador Bader, you mentioned the decline in U.S. opinion of China, and recent studies have shown that only like 38% of Americans view China approvingly. Like 4 years ago, that number was 51%. So what do you see to be the root causes for some of these trends, and what can be done to kind of reverse that with two countries that, as you said, are destined to be interdependent going forward?
Wonderful question. Shall we start with the stock market with Gao Xixing? Mr. Gao Xixing.
Okay, the answer to that question, that, that whether or not the recent government intervention into the stock market would put a stop or have a long-term negative effect of the reform process, that's really a depends on things, because right now this is immediately after the correction, and I've been proposing to the government that we should immediately start a committee investigating on the reason why this happened. You know, it's no longer useful to discuss whether or not the government should or should have not interfered with the market. The government did it, and it was, in the words of the popular media, it's saving the market by violence. And the violence is already done. But to me, the most important thing is why would this market be allowed to develop into that sort of thing? And if you actually look at the technical side of the things, there are many, many issues with this the happening of this so-called crash. But quite a few of those would relate to the shorting technology, relating to allowing OTC market to lend the money into the market so that the actual margin was no longer 50%, but somewhere come down to 10% or even 5%. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, of course, you can. That's a good recipe for any crash, that, you know, thinking about a 1929 crash here. So if the government looks at it and come back and contemplate on it and form a committee looking at all these issues. And I think that there's going to be probably it's a positive indication that the government is going to continue with the financial reform and make the market more market rather than making the market a sort of government-controlled institution. At the same time, of course, a lot of people are complaining about various other issues, especially these conspiracy issues about, you know, foreign money coming in, trying to disturb the market, or some political factions coming in exactly to stop the market from going further into the market. But that, you know, I personally don't, you know, as a long-term regulator, I would think that there are so many things that we can do as regulators that the market, you know, we have to learn from the U.S., from other, mostly this country, rather than many of our European friends, that you know, you look at every time after the crash, you look at the things, you immediately, you know, mount your fences on these technical issues, so that eventually people would not think of all these fancy ideas of conspiracy. By that time, things would be narrowed down to a few issues. That would be much easier. So I think for China today, I would quote from Ray Huang, the many Chinese people here probably know Huang Renyu. He once said that China was never, for 2,000 years, was never used to running the country mathematically, because we don't. The Chinese always have this way of doing things by, you know, in a much more sort of the Chinese painting the mechanism, where we just do it by a Taoist way of doing things by not doing things. But today, in today's world, the market has become so sophisticated and a country becomes so populous that we really have to run the market, run the system with mathematical accuracy. And I think we have a lot to do in that regard. Once we do that, I don't think we need to worry that much about those other political issues, because those issues are beyond my scope and beyond the scope of most people. Yeah. We can't really do it, because that's God's will. But for the regulators, we really can do a lot.
Mm, good. For the AIIB issue, would the, Mr. Director Zheng Xinli be comfortable in answering? 您愿意回答这个问题吗？就是 AIIB 刚刚那个。
How come that President Hu didn't listen to you, but the President Xi listened to you? Since for the my suggestions for AIB that I proposed back in 2009, and at the time that I attended the Boao Forum, I proposed that suggestion. And at the time, I proposed to establish two banks. One is Asia Infrastructure Bank, and one is the Asia Agriculture Bank. Now, so from 2009 to 2014, in the 6 years of time, that we have a study of this topic, and that we have a lot of papers coming out on this one. I think in the first few years, the situation, the conditions were not mature. And after the 18th People's Congress, and that the conditions were mature. And also that the President Xi made the decision there. And also in the G20 meeting, also in APEC, in Indonesia, he made the announcement himself in Indonesia during the APEC meeting. So the decision of establishing AIIB, I made the proposal, and it is based on three considerations. First is that the infrastructure investment in Asia is huge. According to the Asia Development Bank, until 2020, that will be the $8 trillion of the need for investment in infrastructures. That for such a large need, that such a huge need, that will not be satisfied the World Bank or other an Asia Development Bank, and it will be very difficult for those countries to do the financing themselves too. And so that, and IFF, the Politburo in Laos invited me over there to give a speech. So when I was giving speech there, that when I went to Cambodia and Laos and there, those people there, they were living in the very shabby place. But it's so poor. But they have so much of resources. They have so much of those good land. But they don't have 1 mile of a highway. There's no infrastructure there. And the second is that China has a huge foreign reserves, and we are trying to find a way out for those to use those foreign reserves. And third is that China is a large country, is a big country in Asia, to help our neighboring countries so that other countries can get on the wagon of our development. That will be helpful to them. And then with the infrastructures, then that we can exchange with our countries. That we can transform the resources advantages of those countries into economic advantages, and that we can meet our agricultural products need. And so this is a win-win situation. So such a proposal for AIIB that is all benefits, nothing harmful. And it's not exclusive either. We hope that the Japan, the U.S., any countries who wants to be part of it will be part of the AIIB, because this is good thing, good deed to do. So that's why the China proposed the establishment of AIIB. And that Jin Lichun, he is a very talented person, and he was the vice chairman of the World Bank, and he's fluent in English, and he understands the Asia situation. His English is actually better than his Chinese, so actually this is a very good condition for him to do his work. So that I believe that operation with AIIB will be very smooth, especially with the leader of with the experiences of World Bank and the and ADB, and we can learn from them, and also with their help. They would have set a very high standards, and they would have a mechanism that's based on the market mechanism. And that AIB will have a bright future. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Chen, I want to talk about that. You said the conditions were not mature, and later on the conditions were mature. What do you mean by that specifically? Does it have to do with leadership style? No, it has nothing to do with that. It's basically, it's more the economic development in, as a whole, and the China's capability to invest overseas, and also the demand for financial demand of every country. And I think by 2014, all the conditions are in place, are mature. Before that, the conditions are just not mature enough.
Of American citizens of China.
Sure. Those numbers have fluctuated down through the years quite a bit. And the numbers about favorable ratings towards the United States and China have fluctuated similarly. I don't, frankly, worry enormously about where the number happens to be at a particular time. But as to why that's the case, look, I think there are multiple factors, and they have to do with the rise of China, with China's relations with its neighbors, with the South China Sea and East China Sea frictions. I think they have to do at least as much with with economic anxieties in the United States, middle class wage stagnation over the last generation, as China's economy has, rocketed ahead, and the concern among ordinary Americans that we either are not or will not be the preeminent economy in the world before terribly long. It's sort of anxieties. It has to do with, I think, the propensity of the American media to look for exciting stories rather than true stories in many cases, and so to highlight and in many cases exaggerate what the Chinese are doing and what their intentions are. And I think it has to do with the fact that we have a new leadership situation in China. I mean, basically, we have a leader who is much more decisive than any leader in China in the last, in the last decade at least. And we have China with orders of magnitude greater capacity, both on the economic side and on the military and security side. So if you put that all together, you have the appearance of a China that could be a revisionist power and alter regional and global balance. I mean, I think that these are very complicated questions. I don't think there's a bumper sticker answer.
Would that low approval rating of China feed into the upcoming presidential election, making the election extremely focused on China?
No. I think that the three big foreign policy issues in the upcoming election are going to be the Iran nuclear deal, ISIS and terrorism, and Russia, Ukraine, and Russia's relations with Eastern Europe. China is, I would say, a distant fourth. China can become in the top three if something dramatic happens in the region. And I don't expect, and I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But look, I was once briefing President Obama before, I think it was before Hu Jintao's visit. And we were talking about what we might achieve on the visit in on economic issues, on security issues, and on human rights issues. And in my briefing, I basically said, "Oh, here's where we are: economic issues, a mixed picture; security issues, we have a substantial set of agreements; and human rights, of course, nothing," which was always the case in our bilateral visits.
And President Obama's reaction was, well, the American people care much more about the economic issues than they do about the other issues in the relationship. And my reaction to that was not to correct his assessment of the judgments of the American people. I said to him, I think you can judge the attitude of the American people better than I can. You've demonstrated that. But all the issues are important. But when President Obama, who I think has his finger on the pulse of ordinary Americans much more than I do, certainly, and probably more than people in this room, says that economic issues are what's on the minds of ordinary Americans, I believe him.
Can I just very quickly add? So I agree with Jeff. I think the main issues that have affected opinion over the last year are the security issues he mentioned. But I would just add that it used to be that the U.S. business community was a kind of cheerleader for China. They would weigh in about the benefits of the economic relationship. U.S. business community is really soured on China very much, for a variety of reasons having to do with cyber attacks, implementation of the anti-monopoly law. But I think the most important issue is that, China is still relatively closed to foreign investment in the service sector. So many sectors that are important to the U.S., they started doing a little bit of investing in China with joint ventures and partial opportunities, and they thought things would open up, and now they're frustrated that things are not opening up.
Maybe the upcoming visit of President Xi may make some progress. Let's hope in this regard, right? Okay, next round. A friend from VOA, your last question last time.
Paige from Voice of America. Yes, talking about governance, we know that crony capitalism or 权贵资本主义 now is a dangerous topic in China. If you insist talking about it, you'll get fired, if not arrested. So what's our panelist's take on that? That's my question.
I think I will direct that question to Gao Xiqing because you... I guess you're more familiar with the Chinese internet than our friend in VOA living in China, right? So you can correct his judgment on this one or not, right? Maybe his premise. Later on. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Our friend in the back.
My name is Miguel Algarin from the U.S. Congress Korean National Assembly Exchange Program. So my question is, as China begins to assert itself with territorial disputes between Philippines, Japan, and Vietnam, and the U.S. has announced a pivot militarily towards East Asia, Mr. Bader expressed his opinion that he thinks the U.S., future U.S. administrations will try to pursue stability with the relationship. But I'm curious, from the Chinese standpoint, as the potential for confrontation increases between U.S. and China, how they feel that potential may impact the relationship or the specifically the economic relationship between the two countries.
One more question. In the back. I would always want to reward people sitting in the back, right?
Yeah, my name is Özgür. I'm from Turkish University. I wonder that how will China's rising economic power affect regions, Asia Pacific region, and the small countries of the region? And do you see any cooperation or contradiction, friction between these countries and China? And also, I wonder that what are the priorities of the China and U.S. Towards this region? Thanks.
Word, what was the last word?
Towards this region.
What are the priorities of U.S. and China towards this region?
Central Asia.
No, Asia-Pacific region.
Asia-Pacific region. Okay. Please, pick up.
Well, I'll take that last one. I think that's really the only one that's appropriate for me. So, it's hard for me to speak for China, but I think these recent initiatives like AIB and One Belt, One Road, we haven't said much about One Belt, One Road, but Zhang Xinli, I think, articulated the logic of China going out. Chinese companies have a lot of capabilities. They want to invest. China has an interest in improving infrastructure. So I view all of that really as quite positive, and that's why I've been supportive of that. And I think the fact that so many developing countries quickly signed up for AIB, you know, that's a sign that the region welcomes this. Countries like Vietnam, Philippines, that have somewhat difficult relations with China, they don't hesitate to try to strengthen the economic relationship. So I think that's very telling. We've talked a little bit about TPP, so I like to make the point that China's initiatives are strengthening the hardware of trade and integration in the region. The United States, frankly, puts more focus on the software, right? So TPP is really all about upgrading the rules of trade so that trade and services can proceed, protect intellectual property rights, create an investment foundation. So I think it's interesting that some of the countries that quickly signed up for AIB, they're also negotiating the TPP arrangement with the U.S. So I think a lot of the countries in the region see no contradiction between participating in the Chinese initiatives, but also welcoming this U.S. vision of deeper integration. My hope is that in the long run, these two will come together. So we might see the U.S. eventually join AIB. Jeff Bader has said not in the near future, but you can imagine the U.S. eventually joining AIB. I can imagine China eventually either joining TPP or trying to negotiate something equivalent. So I think that's my vision for the region is, you know, we're going to need the infrastructure, but the software of integration is equally important, arguably more important.
Potential of military conflict? Ambassador Bader, only you can answer that.
No, sure. I can answer that easily. Look, the U.S. and China are negotiated an agreement last year on encounters at sea for communication between our Navy and the PLA Navy. I think they're going to be negotiating a comparable agreement before President Xi's visit on encounters between aircraft. I think that stems from the recognition that the highest likelihood of conflict comes from accident, not from intention. Mm-hmm. Neither the U.S. nor China has any intention of a conflict. Okay, the only scenario I can envision of a conflict would be where someone does something stupid in an airplane or in a Navy vessel, and there is an episode, mm-hmm. and then a demand for retaliation that produces some kind of short-term exchange between military forces. I'm not predicting that. I'm just trying to worst case what we need to worry about. I think that the idea that two nuclear powers are going to descend into a major conflict is not something that certainly I stay up at night worrying about.
How about a third party intentionally, unintentionally provoke something, dragging the U.S. and China into a conflict?
Well, I think that, you know, what we've seen, and the questioner I think touched on this quite properly, you know, what we've seen in the East China Sea and the South China Sea is a perception on part of the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan that a rising China is a threat to their sovereign claims, to these various rocks and atolls in the area. And they have in turn sought to increase their security ties with the U.S. In response. I think that, you know, a lot of Chinese I talk to think that the U.S. is orchestrating this response, which from my perspective is not the case. We have these countries coming to us because of concerns about Chinese conduct. We have to find a way of managing the situation. The notion that, you know, China and Japan, for example, that their relationship is dominated by, you know, a couple of rocks in the East China Sea that have a few goats on them and no people, that, you know, that this is the dominant issue in China-Japan relations when China and Japan are thoroughly integrated economically and from a trade and investment point of view and cultural ties and historical connections, positive and negative, that it's all about rocks, is frankly ridiculous. And I think I'm very pleased that Xi Jinping and Prime Minister Abe have seemed to have put a safety net under the relationship of late. They've met a couple of times. I suspect they'll meet again. It's not going to be a warm relationship anytime soon, but at least it's no longer plummeting. And I think we need a comparable process in the South China Sea. You know, there's supposed to be a code of conduct. All parties agreed to negotiate a code of conduct when they signed the Declaration of Conduct. I think it's important that serious efforts towards negotiation of a serious code of conduct be revived.
And the issue of crony capitalism. I thought there are much more sexy topics in the internet, right? About corruption, incidents, you know, mysteries of claimed mysteries of officials. So this, to me, this is not a... What do you think? This is not an intentional topic, right? It's not a topic people are talking about.
Quite widespread on the internet. So I don't think that that you cannot talk about it. And maybe the official media would refrain from talking about anything that's too provocative. But these things, this term was really created by Professor Wu Jingliang, who's still, you know, very much vocal in many ways. And we read about his... speeches and his articles all the time. So he's never shy about claiming that we are suffering from very much of that in various ways. But I think since the new government came in and it was the anti-corruption movement, popular sentiment against that has waned hugely because, you know, people no longer... Of course, you always have people complaining about it, but the thing is, it's no longer something that everyone immediately, you know, gets up and say, oh, that's so bad. Most of these people, especially in crony capitalism, the people who stand to benefit the most are the children and relatives of these very high-ranking officials, powerful people. But now these people are all so careful, so afraid about the you know, Mr. Wang Qishan's institution that I don't think anyone would just actively go out and try to, you know, do things against the popular sentiment. So it is still a big issue, but it's no longer as much of an issue as say 2, 3, 4 years ago. And I think the people have been waiting for the government to come out with a detailed set of rules, not only addressing the symptoms, but really addressing the roots of the problem. That we have always been, you know, the same as Professor Wu, same as Professor Li here. I have always been advocating on the overall long-term fundamental set of rules so that the government officials can no longer have that much power to wield. So that's probably more relevant than the, you know, just the symptoms itself.
I think we have time for three very quick questions.
It's 12. It's like 12:26 now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How about as a compromise? How about you take one question as a compromise, okay? Or actually,
how about this? We ask three questions. We pick only one. It's competition. Competition. Which one is sexiest, right?
Sure, that's fair.
How about that?
Okay.
Okay. Three very quick ones, okay? Competition starts, right? A lady in the back.
Unless people want to eat lunch, so.
Hi, my name is Yuji Sao from Seoul National University. I'm here as a congressional exchange student. I wanted to ask more about the Chinese domestic policy, about how there are multiple voices in China domestically joining in, chiming into the foreign policy of the Chinese government. So I wanted to know what the Chinese government, especially on the internet, people thought about AIIB. There's been, I think there is an assumption
that... Got it. Okay, we got a question, right? Let's move on. Okay, let's see. This gentleman has been raising hands for several rounds. Yeah, please, be quick.
Thank you. My name is Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. And I hope my question will be chosen by Mr. Bader. It's a little bit personal. It seems to me that the U.S. is, at least in the academic circle, is debating its policy toward China. Somebody said the U.S. should not continue to engage with China. And are you concerned that your modest voice is being overwhelmed by those who suggest that the U.S. should be more tougher and contain China?
Okay.
If you have an opportunity, would you like to join the campaign with Hillary Clinton or whoever?
That's a sexy question. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, last one. Okay. Gentlemen, to my right.
I'm Randall Doyle from Georgetown University. Very quickly, over the past 6 months, the Chinese government, Xi Jinping, has been cracking down on human rights lawyers. I think over 200 have been arrested, individuals have disappeared. And very quickly, is this indicative of some new wave, some new domestic situation that's evolving that perhaps we don't know about, but why they're cracking down on this particular group of individuals and their work in China?
Got it. I think the sexiest question is whether Ambassador Bader will join the campaign. That's sexy. The most difficult one being the last one. Which one do you want? Sexy or important? Can we voice? Quick. Important. Okay, important question. You're a lawyer. You're a lawyer, right? Gao Xixing, you were trained as a lawyer.
That's a very dangerous question. Well, I read about it in various ways, but I don't think people have great differences to the number. Because you said 200. This is the first time I hear such a large number. But some people said 100, and recently someone said it's only 6. And people who were actually affected, I heard it was about 100, but most of those people were caught in by the police and questioned and then let go. So now there's only 6 people arrested. But I'm not privy with the numbers. The way I look at it is because I had a glimpse of the central government TV on that, and they claim that these lawyers were instigating people to start. It's like these ambulance chasers trying to really start trouble and doing things. That's from the official TV. I personally do not have enough facts on that. But China and I have 170,000 lawyers, and there must be lawyers who try to instigate trouble that I'm sure anywhere in the world. But on the other hand, I also have a lot of lawyer friends. Many people called me and asked me that they were very much concerned, because as a lawyer myself, at least former lawyer, I would consider the protection of the lawyers' rights to at least to speak for their clients, to say things, is important in a society, especially for a stable society. And I think the purpose of the government to do whatever is to what we call waven, to maintain the stability. If we do want to maintain the stability, then of course we will let people talk and let people vent to their frustration they have. So I don't know what exactly is happening, but I would hope that the government would do things by the law rather than by some political enthusiasm. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Thank you. Thank you for your very brief and answer to this difficult question. Okay, I would like to give final words to David Dollar, who is the conductor producer of this whole program. But before that, let me say only one thing. I learned one thing to be a successful think tank. That it start with wonderful audience. Today we have a wonderful audience, wonderful questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah, excellent.
That was an ending that I can endorse. So we had a great audience. We had another great panel with this group. We had a lot of frank questions. And so, I think this contributes to a better relationship between China and the U.S., just having this non-governmental group having a frank discussion. So now we finish the program. There's lunch for the Chinese delegation, and the rest of you are on your own. So.